After public comment.
After.
Hey, where's my timer? Oh, it's all right.
Jamie! I was going to get on the mic and you just...
I think Brian will be here, I think.
Let me know when
Are we good to go?
I'll let you know when I need you to yell
Good
for
morning.
Me.
I'd like to call the Costa Commission to order on this Friday morning and ask Ms. Miller to call the roll, please.
Commissioner Bloom.
Here.
Commissioner Bochco. Commissioner Burke? Here. Commissioner Gurney?
Here.
Commissioner McClure?
Here.
Commissioner Resnick?
Here.
Commissioner Stewart?
Here.
Commissioner Zimmer?
Here.
Chair Schellenberger?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Let me just lay out how we're going to go through this morning. We're going to take a half an hour of public comment. And so those of you who know, I have many more than 10 speaker slips here. The speakers that we do not get covered in the first 30 minutes, we will take before lunch break. After the public comment, we're going to go into closed session for probably 15 minutes. We'll ask the public to clear the room, and then we will come back in and begin on our agenda items, starting with agenda number 4. So with that, we'll go to the public comment, John Rizzo, and then David Naftalin, and if the second person could come forward and be in the front row so we can move right along here. 3 minutes. One, two, three. Yeah. And your name for the record. Your name for the record.
John Rizzo, President of the Marina Tenants Association. Not only have I been involved in the marina for 35 years, as an activist. Lately, I've spilled over into the beaches along Venice. I have a health food store near Rose and Lincoln, which is on one end of the Venice Beach area, and I walk through that area and through Venice. And Venice, as you probably know, the Venice Beach is the second largest attraction other than Disneyland in all of Southern California. And our beaches are famous here, and I want to thank you all for protecting them, because without the Coastal Commission, we'd be in sad shape. We're already under immense attack in the marina and have been for years, and I think all the beaches up and down the coast are under attack. But I've noticed that when I walk through Venice on these real hot days on the weekends, that the cars are just coming down Washington and are gridlocked. They're coming down Venice and are gridlocked. And I also noticed that there's not enough parking for the cars. And there doesn't seem to be a plan in the city to do anything about that. We tried to get a bike path down the peninsula, which is a couple miles of pristine beaches. It's almost a private beach for the people along there. And the Venice Neighborhood Council approved it unanimously, but Mr. Rosendahl, the councilman for that area, turned it down. One of the lots that is for the market rate senior citizen could be used for parking, and I've tried to get the county to signage it properly so that people would use it, because hardly anybody uses it, but I've failed in that effort too. Nobody seems to care about the public, and the beaches have gone up 78% usage since 2005. Our beaches, and just reported in the Times. Also, the Department of Beaches and Harbors has quit the maintenance of the washrooms as they should. And they had a big article in the Times, which you have in that packet. Now they say they're going to move. They're not going to take it completely away. They're going to move up and do some more cleaning, but not quite what they used to do. That's a travesty not to clean the washrooms. And people from all over the world come to these beaches. It's a revenue generator. It's, I believe, unbelievable. And yet, there just doesn't seem to be any interest from the councilman to the supervisor, Mr. Kanabe, for the marina, for the councilman for Venice. There doesn't seem to be a care about the beachgoers. Thank you.
David Naftalin, and then Dorothy Franklin.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is David Naftalin. I'm an attorney who has been involved with the Marina Tenants Association for over 30 years, and I am here to speak to the issue of the application of the County of Los Angeles to amend its local coastal plan, the LCPA, regarding Marina Del Rey, which I am told will be heard by the Commission in October. Your decision is a momentous one because the approval sought by the county is the opening wedge for a rather alarming increase in the amount and density of construction and traffic and so forth at Marina Del Rey, without any commensurate benefit to the public. The Marina Tenants Association has already submitted a package of documents, and I plan to submit later a brief letter fleshing out the points I am summarily making in these oral comments. But first, I am now going to explain to you the background of the history of the history and politics of the realities of land use policy at Marina Del Rey from the beginning to the present time. Why, we might ask, is the county carrying the developer's water in this LCPA? Why are they working so hard to obtain approval for this hodgepodge of overdevelopment that is nothing but a wish list of projects sought by the lessees, that is, by the concessionaires at Marina Del Rey? The answer is that the county is compromised because the Board of Supervisors and the Small Craft Harbor Commission and the department and staff have colluded with the lessees, who happen incidentally to be the board's biggest campaign contributors, to allow the lessees to make enormous profits while the county gets little or nothing. Here's how this works. The California Constitution requires that public land, like Marina Del Rey, be held in the public interest. Back in the 1950s and 60s, at the time of the enactment of the legal documents governing the letting of the leaseholds and the constructing of this public recreational facility, the county chose two means of upholding the public use doctrine. The first means was designed to protect the county's and the taxpayers' interest in the value of the land itself. This was to be accomplished by the lessees making percentage rental payments to the county based on the appraised value of the leaseholds. This means of governmental control and oversight over public land has been defeated by a series of ploys, but primarily by the simple expedient of lowballing the appraised values of the leaseholds and then lowballing the amount of the percentage rentals to the county. The second means of governmental control was intended to protect the public's interest in access to Marina Del Rey, the only public small craft harbor in Los Angeles County. This interest was to be protected by price control, which in turn was defeated by brazenly abandoning price control and allowing prices to float to the highest the market will bear. Both methods are paid lip service in the standard marina lease, but are flouted in practice. The county abandoned the very legal controls which it had selected in order to comply with the public use doctrine, allowing the lessees to rake off huge yearly profits while the county share is minuscule. In sum, having acquiesced in the abandonment of the means of properly governing the marina, the county is now helpless to stanch this proposed avalanche of unnecessary and ecologically disastrous development.
Thank you very much. Dorothy Franklin, and then Penny Alia.
Good morning. I'm Dorothy Franklin, marina resident and boat owner of 26 years. On February 1st, I joined others on a trip to downtown LA for the Board of Supervisors meeting where many of us had only 2 minutes to speak. We voiced our objections to the proposed plan for redeveloping Marina Del Rey into a high-density, high-traffic, high-end shopping, dining, and living area. Only one supervisor was listening to any of us, unlike all of you who are attentive. And three of the supervisors were talking to people leaning over their shoulders for the whole time that we spoke. Don Kanabe's speech was prepared and given within a heartbeat after the last speaker had spoken. A major amendment to the marina land use and development was passed and immediately on its way to you, the Coastal Commission, who are now in Marina Del Rey and slated to make the final decision by October of this year. The LCP was updated in 96 when the LA County was allowed to add a significant amount of new potential development to what existed at that time, which was opposed by the Coastal Commission staff and the marina community. Based on the amended LCP, which was approved by the Board of Supervisors, LA County may still develop almost 2,000 more residential units, which is three times the size of the three marina club towers, over 500 more hotel rooms, which is five times the size of the Jamaica Bay Inn, 1,323 more restaurant seats, three times the size of the Cheesecake Factory, and almost 275,000 more square feet of rental space, which is two times the size of the Waterside Shopping Center, and 3,000 additional square feet of office space, which is three times the size of the Marina Fitness Center. The reason that county officials give us is to allow a handful of developer-driven projects by changing the land use designation on the particles of land that they wanted to develop. The 19 pipeline projects were bundled into three projects because you will only sanction three changes a year. The residents of Marina Del Rey, our opposition lies in a manner that public land has been taken for private developments by LA County. 60% of our land has been privately developed. The law should have been reviewed instead of trying to be changed, and requests for proposals and negotiating lease options, sending the projects through the regulatory process despite having the permits to do so. Our marina needs to be rejuvenated in a way that supports the mandate of Marina Del Rey as a public recreational source. And I just ask all of you to help us save our marina.
Thank you very
much.
And
thank you for your time.
You bet. Penny Aaliyah, and then Ryan Brown.
Good morning, Commissioners. Penny Aaliyah, Coastal Resource Advocate and resident of Laguna Beach. I thank you for your time today, given your very, very heavy agenda schedule this week. I know it was a tough one, but what I want to speak to you today regards the heavy summer beach season that's coming upon us. And I have a PowerPoint for you. This is the Montage Resort in Laguna Beach. The commission issued their CDP in approximately 2001. Their CDP conditions included public access and public parking. Dr. Lester covered the importance of these items in his overview on Wednesday, and also addressed compliance with conditions of CDP, which is what I wish to address. This slide depicts just one of the public parking lots that was conditioned within their CDP and is the focus of what I wish to speak to you about. Since the Montage opened in 2003, they have been non-compliant with their CDP conditions related to public access and parking. These slides that are coming up capture just 1 year of them utilizing and exploiting this public parking lot that was conditioned in their CDP to be used for the public. They use this for hotel operations 365 days a year and have been for the past 8 years. Enforcement staff has already had to address security guards blocking public beach access with them. And we've kind of held off going to staff on this and have tried to work with the Laguna Beach Police Department, Laguna Beach Code Enforcement, and then Code Enforcement sent me over to the Recreation Department. Thus far, all attempts to work with the city on CDP compliance for this property that consistently violates the conditions of their CDP have failed. And this is why I'm speaking to you today. We'd really like some help from staff on this to work with the city of Laguna Beach, work with this property owner, and return the public's parking to the public. We've exhausted all the other remedies, and this exploitation of public parking needs to cease and desist. 8 years of noncompliance with the Coastal Act is 8 years too long. Please help us reclaim our public parking. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ryan Brown, and then Sadiq Hassan.
Thank you. I'm Ryan Brown, the ASB president at Malibu High School. We came here today to speak on behalf of lights on the Malibu High School football field. Although it's going to be on the agenda in the summer, we came to tell you why we think it's very important. Students at Malibu High School do not have a place to go at night on the weekends. We live in a very rural area in Malibu. There isn't very much for us to do. And on Friday nights, I've witnessed myself, students just flocking in like places like our market parking lot and waiting for a text message to tell us where we should go for a party. They're really the only option really at night for teenagers in Malibu is the movie theater, and that gets old after a couple weeks in a row. And then also at Malibu High School, we lack a strong sense of school spirit that other schools have because of their football team. In high schools, the football team is often the driving force behind their school pride. At Malibu, the disappearance of night games has caused students' attachment to the football team to drop dramatically. Since the lights have been gone, our homecoming has gone from an event that hundreds of students used to come to an event that only 15 students come to the homecoming dance. This year, our ASB decided not to have a homecoming dance because we feared that the lack of attendance would happen again this year. If we even have limited use of our lights on the football field, there would be a dramatic positive impact on our school, and I ask that you consider our proposal. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Let's see, Sadiq Hassan, and then Catherine Ibarra.
Good morning, Coastal Commission. My name is Sadiq Hassan, and I am speaking on behalf of all the students and athletes at Malibu High School on the temporary lights for our field. I've played three different varsity sports during my 2 years at Malibu High School, so I've experienced many different games and crowds at my school as well as many other schools. And during these games, I've noticed that teams who play night games have bigger crowds with more school spirits for any sport. But during our basketball season, I was fortunate enough to have this big crowd behind me and feel the driving force and feel like make a shot and then have everyone yell like, yeah, good job, and have that pump you up even more to go make another shot. But during football season, we weren't so fortunate. We did not have lights, and our games had to be played during the day where most of our parents who would love to come see us play weren't even able to watch their kid play a single game because they had work and they couldn't get off. And it's really hard coming from a school where you've had all those, like, that experience with big crowds and have people yelling behind you and helping you, and to play at Malibu High School with nothing and know, like, you could have lights, but it's just not happening. It's kind of hard and sad for a lot of us. Me being a senior, I never got to play under the lights at a home game, so I don't know what it feels like to have that crowd during a football game, but I hope you guys make it different for the next couple of years. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Catherine Ibarra, and then Mitch Clarfield.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Catherine Ibarra. I'm the president of Malibu High School Parent Teacher Student Association. I'd like to support the City of Malibu's amendment to the local coastal plan to allow limited lighting at Malibu High School main athletic fields. Thank you so much for your service to the state of California and that your efforts to balance the needs of coastal communities with the beautiful needs of the beautiful coastline that we have. As leader of an organization that seeks to promote welfare of youth, I see that balance as missing in the Malibu community. Limited lighting would allow community events that center on the activities of youth surrounding athletics. Healthy, family-inclusive events where young people challenge themselves both physically and socially. There are 1,200 students that attend Malibu High School and Middle School. The fields serve their families as well as numerous families who attend other schools but play on our fields because we've seen the funding for public school middle schools evaporate and public high schools diminish greatly. So these fields would serve our whole community. They would provide an environment where families can be together on Friday night. I do not have a football player in my family, but I have children that play other sports. And I come and support whichever community event there is and whichever sport the students are playing. Sports are just a great activity for our kids. It's a great activity for our community to rally around. So I would thank you very much for your consideration on this issue, and I look forward to a more youth-oriented balance on the issue of lighting for athletic fields at Malibu High School. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Mitch Clairfield and then Laura Rosenthal.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of families and children of Malibu to speak in support of allowing lights to be installed on the Malibu High School football field. Malibu is the only coastal community between Goleta and San Diego that does not have a lighted high school football field. I didn't continue the research beyond Goleta. I thought that was far enough. The children and families of Malibu deserve whatever every other local community in Southern California already enjoys. During the months, in addition to what you've heard about football, and I too support lights for Friday night football games, but I too don't have a football player in my family. During the months from November through March, when it gets dark at around 5 p.m., there are high school and community sports programs which serve hundreds of children in the community and which suffer due to a lack of fields at which to practice and play games. These sports include football, soccer, lacrosse. Soccer is the largest participatory sport in Malibu. There are 850 children that play AYSO soccer in Malibu and another 70 or 80 who play at the high school level. Half or more of these athletes are female. The high school and portions of AYSO season runs through standard time, so daylight hours are extremely limited. Lacrosse is also gaining popularity and is played during the winter and spring as well. For high school soccer, the need for lighted fields is the most acute. High school practices and games must currently start at 3:15 to have them completed by sundown. This creates a number of challenges. The student athletes must leave classes an hour and a half early to attend their home games so that they can be on the field at 3:15 and ready to go. With at least one home game a week, that they're missing at least one or two classes each week during season. Parents who work are forced to either leave work early or miss their children's games entirely. The volunteers and professionals needed to staff the programs are difficult to find. These volunteers include coaches, managers, team parents, and referees. Lighting conditions are dangerous as the sun sets into the eyes of the west-facing team. Whoever happens to be on the land side in the second half is really disadvantaged, and as the parent of a goalkeeper, it can be very, very precarious to be trying to catch a ball when the sun's right in front of you. Having a practice facility that could be utilized in the early evening during the week would remove a huge burden to the community. These days, lighting technology has improved dramatically. Permanent light installations exist that allow for retractable light posts and shielded ballasts that can cut light pollution by more than 50%. That was fast. Thank you very much. Please support our plan.
Good morning, Commissioners, Chair. I'm not going to take a lot of your time. I'm Mayor Pro Tem of the City of Malibu. And I just wanted to let you know why we, And we're here this morning because we're hoping that this lighting issue is going, our LCP amendment will be heard this summer. But because the meetings will not be in Southern California, I will be going to the meeting, but our parents and our students won't be able to. So I wanted to thank our students for coming today. We actually, this is our first day of finals in our school district, or else we would have had a lot more kids here, but we were able to get a few seniors to come and to speak. And I also wanted to thank the parents and coaches that were able to come today. And that's really the main thing. We look forward to presenting our case to you, hopefully next month, up in Marin County. And we thank you for your work and your dedication. And we will be making our case then. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Honorable Commissioners. My name is Whitney Blumenfeld, and I'm here representing Councilmember Bill Rosendahl. The Councilmember is very concerned with the five projects proposed in the LCP amendment. He's especially concerned with impacts to the Venice community and the Delray community and surrounding communities within Council District 11, and with impacts on traffic, and would like to respectfully request that the traffic impacts are further analyzed and that you, as your commissioners in your role here, take a very careful look at the proposed projects and the amendments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Santos, excuse me? Rosendahl. Santos? Yeah, thank you.
I can speak this afternoon.
You're here. We'd love to hear from you.
Oh.
Unless you prefer this afternoon, but.
I'll do it. I'll do it now. How's that? Hello, my name is Santos Kreiman. I'm the director of the Department of Beaches and Harbors for the County of Los Angeles. Thank you for being here. And thank you for your service. There's, I've been reviewing the tape over the last couple of days about some of the comments that have been made about the county's development plans here in Marina Del Rey. I just want to make sure that that you all know that there has been a tremendous amount of effort on the part of my department, as well as the Department of Regional Planning, to have a lot of public input in our plans. The one thing that you're not hearing is that the plans that I had inherited about 3 years ago before I became the director of Beaches and Harbors has changed drastically, changed significantly. That plan required a lot of development in Marina Del Rey. The one thing that I don't want you to lose is that in 1996, there was a specific amount of development that was granted the County of Los Angeles by this particular commission. The plans that are in place now have significantly been reduced. We are not going to get anywhere near those particular caps that were identified in that particular plan. When I first became the director, my task was to review the plans to determine whether or not the plan was a viable plan or whether it was in the best interest of the community. My decision was that we were going to do more renovation projects as opposed to brand new development that was going to increase the intensity of traffic and housing in Marina Del Rey. I think we've done a very effective job of doing that. You saw yesterday there was a picture of a brand new hotel that was going to go on one of these particular sites. It was a very large hotel, very tall hotel. And we at Beaches and Harbors worked with the developer and said, absolutely not, not in this particular community. You're going to have to do something different. So we have been listening to the community. We have modified our plans. And I look forward to coming before this board in October to lay out those particular issues, to talk to you about our plans, to tell you why it is in the best interest of this particular community. Now, those of you that are council members and supervisors can understand the great strains that the county budget is under now. This particular Marina Del Rey is an asset for the County of Los Angeles. It's a wonderful asset. It will always be a recreational venue. You can see out the windows. There's plenty of boats. If you had an opportunity to stroll around, you saw a lot of kayakers. You saw a lot of rowers. It is a recreational venue. This is the single largest revenue-producing asset that the county does own. The money that's generated here not only goes here in this particular marina, but also pays for services outside to provide access to our coastline. And so I look forward to talking with you more specifically about our project. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, I will close the public comment period for at this time. Commissioner Burke.
Call me Harry, Larry. I'm good.
Okay. I have, actually.
I'm sure you have.
I should call you Larry Bo or Curly.
Commissioner Burke.
In reference to the comments made by Mr. Santos, when we came here.
We can't hear.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Barely. No.
Commissioner Burke, just in dear mic, and I'm sure they'll be able to hear you. Yeah. The IT people are on it.
So I know you can hear me now. Yeah, right. But I remember distinctly you in this room taking part in this kind of initial effort to increase public participation in the process. Because prior to that, it had been a really closed process. And because of our efforts, the director of Beaches and Harbors did resign. The area county planning director of this region did resign. And this process has opened up. Now, like democracy, it's a ever-evolving process. And there are people on both sides of the issue. But I am proud that we, as a commission, opened this process up to public input. And Mr. Santos' process, whether you like the outcome or not, has been an extraordinarily open process.
Thank you. With that, we will now go into closed session, which means we have to ask everybody from the public to clear the room. I think we will be in closed session about 15 minutes. At the end of that, we'll open the doors and resume the rest of the agenda. Thank you.
We're ready to go. Hope? Let's go.
We call the commission back to order and go to our chief legal counsel. Wait. We don't have our court reporter here yet.
Well, that's okay.
Somebody.
Nobody's going to sue us on this. It's all right.
Okay. Go ahead, Chief Legal Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the matter of City of Dana Point versus California Coastal Commission, the Commission received litigation information and advice and gave direction. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we proceed with the agenda, I'm going to ask Priscilla, our court reporter, to talk with the commission a little bit about her role and what we need, our responsibility in helping her fulfill her role.
Good morning. As your court reporter, my job...
I knew I didn't want to do this. Okay, Mary, I'll get back at you. Yeah. My job is to protect the record so that naturally I don't have requests for transcripts of everything, but it usually if it goes into court, it has to go before a judge. And the judge wants as clean a record as possible so that people can make proper decisions from them. So that's my job. And sometimes I carry it out and get too frantic about it, which I did yesterday. And I just wanted to let you know that nods of the heads and a signal like this doesn't mean anything on the record because I can't put it down. If I put down so-and-so nodded, well, what's a nod? Then the judge is going to say, you know, this could be a nod, but that could be a nod. And so if I don't hear it, it doesn't go down. So it's important that we keep that record clear because then when you do have to go into court, you're going to be represented responsibly. Not so verbal. My next note here is just it's very important to have you verbalize your requests and your seconds to motions. It's very important. I won't give his name, but we do have a commissioner here who was making a lot of seconds yesterday by doing this. And yeah, you were. That doesn't count. And even though the chair will say seconded by whomever, there was an incident yesterday when she said seconded by whomever, and then whomever said, no, I didn't second it. It was seconded by someone else. So just keep things verbal as much as possible. Oh, Peter. You know, I have to take down what you say, too, so watch yourself. And I've had a system with the chair when I need a break, as I'll stick my red pen in. There's a hole in my stenograph machine, and I stick it in there. So if you ever see the red pen, it'd be a good idea to let the chair know that the court reporter is just about to fade. And I think that is it. Yeah, that should do it. Just realize that it's very important that what you are saying goes into court as accurately as possible, and that's what I work at doing. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Priscilla. I think the only thing that I would add to that on your behalf is that I know there are times when there are conversations between commissioners up here at the dais while the hearing is going on, and it can be very hard for her to actually hear the main testimony or the main whatever if there's a rumble of background of voices coming from the dais. So I think we owe it to Priscilla and to our attorneys who are need a clear record when they go to court to have no conversations up here other than the commissioner or the whoever's testifying. So,
Madam Chair.
Jamie.
I also wanted to add, one, I really truly appreciate Priscilla's efforts in giving us wonderful records. They are wonderful. Secondly, I would also urge you not to speak over one another. It's much better if only one person's speaking at a time. Sometimes we get excited and sometimes you want to jump in, but it's very difficult for her. The record will end up with the name with dots and all sorts of stuff. It just is not a very legible record then. But and for members of the audience, one of the reasons we ask you to state your name for the record every time you come up to the podium, and I think maybe we should do this at the beginning of the meetings, is tell people why, is we can't remember who you are from time to time. So we ask that you state your name, and please spell it if it is difficult to spell.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Zimmer.
Thank you. I want to say, first of all, one of the great pleasures of walking into this room was seeing Priscilla again after so many years, and her work is really wonderful, and anxious to do everything we can to support it. Maybe I could take a moment here to raise the related issue about the record, the concern that I had developed. I had talked to Mr. Douglas and to the chair briefly as a new commissioner and being inundated with paper throughout the course of the hearing to me is very difficult because I don't know a lot of times who the paper has come from, what it's supposed to represent, when I'm supposed to be looking at it. So I find myself distracted from hearing public comment, distracted from hearing items, trying to sort through. And also concerned that when items come to us, they're part of the record whether we've read them or not. And there appears to be a presumption that if they've been put in front of us that we have read them. If other commissioners have this sense or this concern, I was wanting to talk with staff about maybe coming up with some procedures. Obviously, we need to keep the public access and keep the documents coming in, but to try and put some constraints on it so it's a little bit more organized would be helpful to me. Thank you.
I absolutely agree. It's impossible when you're in the middle of a hearing and you get those thick stacks, you know, from each different applicant or whoever's putting it through. You can't read it. You've got to be paying attention. What is that, me?
Yes, there you go.
Okay. But anyway, I want to second what she said.
Well, unless there's an objection, I'm fine with Commissioner Zimmer working with our staff on seeing if there's a procedure that both works for us and maintains the public's ability to put things onto the record. I think that's a great idea. Thank you.
With that, Madam Chair, if we could go over the changes on the agenda, and I'll ask Bob to do that.
Good morning, commissioners. There are three changes to the agenda in the memorandum that was distributed to you. The first is on page 14 of the agenda, item 11A, which is the appeal of Freshwater Tissue Company, LLC. That's postponed. Also on page 14, item number 11B, the appeal for Caltrans. That item is postponed. And lastly, on page 14, item 12A, the appeal for Blueport LLC is postponed as well. And I may just take this opportunity to remind people in the audience that if they would like to speak to the commission, they need to fill out a speaker slip on the table outside the doorway and hand it to a staff member. And the table also contains copies of addendum and some of the agenda items in a binder that you're welcome to look through. And finally, please, if people could turn off cell phones or put them in a quiet mode, that won't disrupt the meeting.
With that, Madam Chair, we come to the Energy and Ocean Resources Federal Consistency part of the agenda. I just have one immaterial amendment to report to you. It was handed out to you. This is a repair to an existing pier, oil pier, to repair a number of piers that are deteriorating by putting sleeves around them. This is, in essence, consistent with an amendment to a previous permit. So we did get one letter of objection seeking to have this set as a regular hearing item. We don't think that the objections raised warrant that, because we think all of the concerns that were raised relative to potential impacts of this repair project have been addressed by conditions in the permit, and so we would continue to treat this as an immaterial amendment. So unless there's an objection from commissioners, this immaterial amendment will be deemed approved.
Thank you. Is there any unwillingness for concurrence with the immaterial amendment? Seeing none, it's concurrent with.
That brings us to item 6A, which is a consistency determination by the Bureau of Indian Affairs for a fee-to-trust land acquisition of three parcels of land totaling 22.5 acres for the Smith River Rancheria in order to provide trust lands for the rancheria to construct residential, commercial, office, and retail projects on property in Del Norte County. I should note that to save travel costs and reduce the number of staff that have had to travel to this meeting, I'm presenting this item on behalf of our federal consistency staff. Larry Simone, the analyst who prepared the recommendation, is watching the proceedings in San Francisco, and if need be, I can call him to answer any questions that I can't address myself. There was an addendum packet distributed this morning. It's a green packet, item F6A, which contains a couple of letters relevant to the project, including a letter from the Smith River Rancheria in support and a letter from a neighbor, Ron Hibbler, who opposes the project. And then you'll also see a color version of the letter from the Rancheria in a binder that's also in front of you that was distributed this morning. This consistency determination would transfer three parcels of land currently owned in fee by the Smith River Rancheria into federal trust status, and the trust parcels would be subsequently developed by the tribe with 26 single-family homes over 19.1 acres and a 15,000 square foot building that would provide community-serving commercial retail space on 1.7 acres. There's also 1.8 acres of land that'd be designated as open space. Next slide, please. Oh, there it is. Thank you. The three parcels are located on the east side of Highway 101, 3 miles north of the town of Smith River near the Oregon border. The parcels are not contiguous with the rest of the Rancheria's trust lands, which are located about a half mile to the south. The three parcels involved are shown in slide three. Essentially, the southern parcel is currently vacant. The middle parcel has an existing home on it, and the third parcel, which is the largest parcel to the north, currently has two residents on it. The standard of review for this consistency determination is the Chapter 3 policies of the Coastal Act and not the Del Norte County LCP. But because the LCP has been certified by the Commission and incorporated into the California Coastal Management Program, the LCP can provide guidance to the Commission as you review the consistency with the Coastal Act. If the lands are placed into federal trust status, development on the parcels would no longer be subject to state and local government land use and development regulatory controls. Now, some of those of you on the commission that have been around for a while may remember at the April commission meeting, the staff recommended objection to the BIA's proposed fee to trust action due to concerns that the subsequent development proposed by the tribe would be inconsistent with the Chapter 3 policies. However, at the conclusion of the hearing and prior to commission action, the BIA requested that this item be continued to this meeting today in order to discuss modifications, and several commissioners also directed staff to re-examine its recommendation and determine if some level of community-serving commercial retail development at the site could be found to be consistent with the Coastal Act. In May, commission staff participated in a conference call with staff from the BIA and members of the tribe. And during this call, the BIA and the tribe stated that they had modified the proposed tribal development plan that would occur subsequent to the fee to trust transfer. The proposed commercial development on the northern portion of the property has been eliminated in exchange for an open space area, and the commercial retail portion of the future development would be limited to the southwest portion of the area involved. The commercial retail development has been reduced from a total of 18,000 to 15,000 square feet, and the commercial space itself, the brown building on the lower right of this slide four, would basically include a grocery store, a post office, bank, visitor center, other community-serving facilities. The BIA and the tribe also provided to commission staff draft language for a tribal ordinance that would restrict development of the subject parcels to that proposed in the consistency determination. With all those changes, the staff is now recommending that you concur with this consistency determination and based on the following, based on the findings in the staff report. The existing residential development surrounding the project area, except for a small mobile home park immediately adjacent, ranges in density from 0.4 to 8.8 dwelling units per 2 acres. The proposed density for the subject parcels is equivalent to 3 dwelling units per 2 acres, or 1.5 per 1 acre. While this exceeds the density that be allowed under the LCP general plan and zoning ordinance for the parcels, which is a limit of 1 dwelling unit per 2 acres, it is similar to the current residential density of parcels in the surrounding area, as you can see on slide 5. There are adequate tribal and public utilities to serve the development, including the tribe's new wastewater treatment plant, and there are no sensitive coastal resources on the parcels that would be adversely affected. The fee to trust transfer would provide for the introduction of commercial retail land use in a rural area of the coastal zone that is essentially devoid of such use at the present time. But as previously stated, the proposal has been modified to restrict such development to the west-southwestern edge of the Bailey parcel and reduce the square footage from 18 to 15,000 square feet. And it would primarily be directed to the the community-serving businesses, as I mentioned before. The development is designed at an appropriate scale to serve the well-documented need for additional tribal housing on and adjacent to the rancheria, as well as the greater residential community north of Lopez Creek. The residential development, we believe, is consistent with the type and density of the existing residential development in the area, and the modified and reduced size of the commercial project represents a balance between a local community-serving project and a larger project designed to serve a wider geographical area. The proposed commercial and residential structures would not block or adversely affect public views along Highway 101, and would not generate significant adverse effects on scenic public views along Ocean View Drive, which is the road inland that runs parallel to 101. The incorporation of by the tribe of residential architectural design standards will minimize the visual resource impacts to public views. And shown here in slide 6, the design of the commercial retail center has been superimposed against an existing aerial photograph of the site. And the commission staff believes that with those types of architectural design standards, the visual impacts will be minimized. We also believe that there's sufficient reason to determine that the residential and commercial projects will in fact be the development that will occur on the parcels after completion of the fee to trust transfer by the BIA. In addition, adequate mechanisms are available to afford the commission the ability to review any future development not proposed in this consistency determination, including reopening the federal consistency process for the project. Now, in your addendum package, as I mentioned, there's an objection letter from Mr. Ron Hibbler, who lives adjacent to the project site. And Exhibit 13 of the staff report includes several emails of his objecting to the project as well. Mr. Hibbler was unable to attend the meeting due to the distance involved, but staff informed him that his objection to the project and a strong disappointment would be brought to your attention. In essence, Mr. Hibbler believes that the residential density is too great and the proposed commercial retail element is not appropriate for the rural area. However, it's staff's view that the BIA's proposed fee to trust transfer and the residential and commercial development proposed by the tribe on the subject parcels is consistent with the concentration of development, public services, visual resource, water quality, ESHA, and cultural resource policies of the California Coastal Management Program. And so, therefore, staff is recommending that the commission concur with the consistency determination. And the motion and resolutions are found on page 6 of the staff report. And I understand that the BIA and the tribe are here this morning to make presentations to you.
Yes, Madam Chair, just in wrapping up here, those of you who were at the hearing on this before, I think appreciate the fact that we did bring it back in short time, short turnaround, that we heard what several of the commissioners were saying about the desirability of having community serving kind of commercial uses here. We also very much appreciate the willingness of the tribe to work with us to address our major concerns by making some modifications to the proposed project. And I was really pleased that we ended up at the end of that conversation in agreement on what we were going to bring forward. That's the way things should happen. They often do. And I'm really pleased that we're here today in agreement for this project.
Thank you. I'll come back to the commission. Are there any ex parte communications to declare? Seeing none, I'll open the public hearing and call Patrick O'Mallon with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And if you'd put your name on the record, and how much time would you like?
Well, Well, together with the tribe and all that, I think 15, 20 minutes.
Sorry?
15, 20 minutes. Myself, just about three minutes.
Let's go with 50. Let's see. So all of the Ross Crabtree door and they're
yes.
all together. All
right. Yes, ma'am.
Why don't you do 15 minutes for your presentation?
Thank you. That'll be well. Good morning. My name is Patrick O'Mallon. I am with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I am here to representing the Smith River Rancheria tribe. And this is regarding the revised project description as presented so well by the chair, commission staff, Robert Merrill and Peter Douglas. Going back in the April 2011 meeting, it was sounded somewhat unfavorable back there. So that's why the BIA and the tribe met together and with conference with the commission staff, worked together and compromised and came up with the revised plan. And with the revised plan, I'm somewhat redundant of what was said earlier, but however, it is very important to mention. We reduce the densities. Commercial and retail space has been removed from one site, the Haswell property, over to the Bartley site, and which provided open space. Lowering the density of the development, tribal ordinance, and we also presented a tribal ordinance so that as an enforcement mechanism for the tribe and staff, in order for us to be able to limit the to stick to what the plan was been revised to. And one of the key, I'm going through some of the key issues that were mentioned then. One was the ability to provide services to the site. Like I mentioned earlier again, the tribe has built recently a sewer wastewater treatment plant, which is running well right now and providing services for that area, which was once all under septic systems right now. So they've shown due diligence in trying to address any kind of issues with wastewater and treatment. And also, the other issue was visual. The tribe recognizes the beauty they have up there, and they have so in for generations now. And to comply with that, the tribe, as will be presented shortly, has provided architectural renderings of how they propose to develop up there, and which will be much more so blended with the natural environment that is provided there, and keeping that beauty of the Del Norte County along the coastline as is. And they have presented, they will, through tribal orders, they will restrict development with the 11 single family residences, I believe. And basically, what I would like to say is the tribe has demonstrated the stewardship of protecting the coastline for many generations now. However, tribal populations have grown, as of any other communities, and the big issue here is housing. And the tribe would love to keep their community together, and that's why this project is very crucial and important for the tribe to go forth. That's all I have for you to present for you today, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Commission staff. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the rest can come forward in whatever order you'd like. put your name on the record, please.
Okay. Russ Crabtree, Tribal Administrator, Smith River Rancheria. I'd like, just like to say good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners. I'm here, and also in the audience is my Tribal Council member, Joel Bravo, sitting right here. I bring you greetings on behalf of the Smith River Rancheria Tribal Council. They would have more liked to have been here, but it's a long distance to travel, and they're quite busy people because they have alternate employment other than being the Tribal Council and working with the Smith River Rancheria. We also have our consultants that are with us, Geo Graney and Dory Beats, and they'll be speaking to you a little later. I just want to give you some general information about Smith River Rancheria. One of the things that I always like to begin with is Smith River Rancheria Tribal Council functions with its integrity. When it says that it's going to do something, it does those things. And it has a planning process. It is a functional government. It has sovereignty that it protects to the extent that it's always practical. But it's always willing to cooperate, communicate, and implement according to plans and the Coastal Commission goals that are consistent with what the Smith River Rancheria's goals as being good stewardess of the resource. I've got some prepared remarks. I'm going to run through some quick slides. As you know, Smith River Rancheria is located in Smith River in the northern part of the state of California, just north of Crescent City. With the Pacific Ocean to the west and the majestic ancient redwoods forest to the east, the Smith River Rancheria is truly one of the most beautiful places on earth. The aboriginal lands of the tribes lays along the Pacific coast, goes between Wilson Creek down by Klamath, California, and south to the Sixus River to the north, which is in another state of Oregon, and inland to the Applegate River. Once it was a vast area, the tribe has consistently struggled to regain lands that will provide homes and businesses for current and future generations. Today, our population exceeds 1,446, to be exact, and there will be additional enrollment, and at that time, then it will exceed that number. Hundreds of other descendants are enrolled in other tribes throughout the Pacific Northwest, a very large tribe, one of the third largest in Northern California. Those remaining in our homeland today continue to pursue their livelihood within our tribe's ancient homelands. Despite the fact, this is a very important key point from our tribal perspective, and we would like to make sure that you understand that the tribe's social fabric was ripped apart by genocide, ethnic cleansing, forced assimilation, boarding schools, religious prohibition, sterilization, and exportation of our lands and our resources, and finally, termination. Today we are rebuilding a nation. A tribal nation is being rebuilt today. We're pursuing economic development. We're building social programs. We're supporting language. We're continuing ceremonies. And we're acquiring our lands to meet our mission statement. And I'd like to emphasize to you the mission statement of the Smith River Rancheria. It says honoring our past. That says a lot to the tribe. Serving our tribal family. That's the 1,446 members that I spoke to. It's protecting our culture and maintaining our independence. And it's controlling our future. Controlling our future is a key point that we're talking about today. We have to control our future in partnership with the state. And so that is why Smith River Rancheria comes to consensus and will cooperate and will communicate, but will not compromise self-determination or sovereignty. And that is not what the Coastal Commission asked us to do. Our missions are alike as being stewards of the resource and maintaining that, but providing for our tribal citizens. As a federally recognized tribe, the Smith River Rancheria feels and understands that it has the right and policies to control our lands and our resources and to maintain the highest standards for environmental quality for our tribal community. The tribe is dedicated, a steward, and culturally based knowledges and practices and insight regarding the difficult task of managing, preserving, and protecting traditional homelands. We are the experts. We are the on-the-ground experts when it comes to that. Like state and local governments, the tribe has developed strategic business plans and master plans and an active comprehensive zoning plans to control development and to ensure our consistency on reservation land use. We are willing to adopt codes and ordinances that designate land use on our land. If you visit Smith River Rancheria, It is pristine land. It is very well maintained, and it is maintained by the Smith River Rancheria through its resources, its staff, and its consistent efforts. So I would like for, if you ever get the opportunity, we'd like to extend that invitation for any of the commissioners to drop by. Regarding our traditional and formal homelands, and regaining it is a huge priority, and land acquisition is necessary for our self-determination. While the tribe understands its concerns of its neighbors, we're here today to illustrate to you that as a tribe, we are always willing to be good stewards of the ocean and the coast of California. Thank you again for the unique opportunity to work in cooperation and collaboration and to identify our similar goals. We look forward to answering any questions. And I would like to introduce Dr. Geo Graining and Dory Beats, our consultants for the project.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Dory Beats. That's D-O-R-E, and last name is spelt B as in boy, I-E-T-Z.
And I'm Dr. Geo Graining. Last name is G-R-A-E-N-I-N-G.
Thank you.
Real quickly, we're going to go through a few slides talking about the project. There's been a lot that's already been said by Commission staff and then also Russ about the revised project as well as the Bureau of Indian Affairs representative. But again, to emphasize the need for the project, it really has to do to providing to those hundreds of members that Russ spoke to, the need for housing is a high priority of the tribe, as affordable housing or community housing is not available near those locations. For the tribe to develop housing, though, it really focuses on kind of that village concept that was mentioned, I think, throughout the staff and several of the correspondents from the tribe. The local zoning policies that are intended for really non-native vacation homes are really inappropriate for tribal community. So building homes that are communal-based, that have your sister or your aunt or your aunt, uncles or your grandmothers next door to you, is very, very important and key to all tribal communities and definitely a priority for Smith River. Some of the quick summary facts, again, after the April hearing, the cooperation between the parties, both the Coastal Commission, the Tribe, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to sit down and look at those issues and revise the project so that we meet each other's goals and protect each other's interest, I think is very key. The consistency with the surrounding areas is demonstrated in the graphics, and Gio is going to go through that quickly again as well. The smart growth and aesthetics, the architectural that the tribe has currently built and will continue to build within its communities, the opportunity to provide community-serving facilities, not only for tribal members as well as visitors, is very key. And the fact that the tribe has governing documents and regulations that govern that land use and help protect the interest of the tribe, but also share with you what is intended on tribal lands.
Go ahead. We'll go fast through these slides since they're somewhat duplicated, but basically the project has been revised and has been made smaller and less dense. You can see the difference here. On the next slide, this is a very small facility. We're talking about 150 by 100 square foot building that would have some PO boxes, a small grocery store, and including a visitor center for tourists to kind of as a portal to the area. And there are some elements of this, the commercial portion of the facility, that are very consistent with the LCP, including the use of green screens, native vegetation, and a constructed wetland to handle all of the stormwater. Won't dwell on this slide, but basically this project would be a good neighbor. It's consistent with the surrounding density and uses. The tribe has consistently built really nice facilities. It's kind of called the Lost Coast Lodge architecture. Lots of post and beam shingles, dark green roofs that blend into the environment. This is going to be a really nice looking facility. And again, this is kind of the picture here. And the land is actually lower than 101, so it actually helps to make sure that there's no blockage of the view of the mountains as well.
And as stated by Russ, the tribe has these governing documents, and as a tribal government, Its service is to provide for its members. And decisions are not made overnight, and they are not made lightly. There's a lot of process that goes into determining what occurs on tribal lands. When tribes acquire land, it may take years for them to get funding to do projects. It may look at the needs of the tribe at that particular time, but it does have a very involved process with its community members through its different committees and then finally through the tribal council itself. So the entire tribe plays a very large role in determining what occurs on tribal lands. They've had approved master plans, a strategic plan, a land use ordinance, a zoning map. They have their own planning board. And they really stay true to making sure that everybody's involved and the interests are met and that there are alternatives that come through. There's a land use ordinance that would limit the use of the project parcels, and this is very key because it would allow for amendments and a designation and input from the commission.
Thank you very much.
It. Thank you.
I appreciate it. With that, if we have no other speaker slips, I'll come back to the staff.
We have nothing else to add, Madam Chair.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Zimmer.
Thank you. Since this is my first meeting and I wasn't present for the original discussion, I do have a couple of questions I'd appreciate. I do appreciate the presentation and the compromise and the attitude of cooperation and continuing cooperation that you all have shown. And this is my first experience with an issue involving tribal land use in the coastal zone, so forgive me. So my question is, because the staff report indicates that once the commission concurs in this, the authority for land use and zoning as represented by the LCP will no longer exist. And that, am I understanding correctly, that if there's an issue down the road, and by the way, I don't have any issue with the current proposal, but if there's an issue 10, 20 years from now with respect to some kind of expansion, is the commission's only role then to reopen the consistency, and how would that work? That's one question. And then the other one I had is this specific land use designation ordinance that's in draft here. Is something I also haven't dealt with before. So I'm wondering whether the architectural elements that you've described that represent the tribal aesthetic are included as part of the commitment in this ordinance. In other words, how I'm reading this is that what has been put before the commission is what is part of the agreement that's represented in the ordinance, and that this project will not be changed without going through the procedures that are set forth for amending the land use designation map. So I'm wondering if that commitment includes this architectural style that you've represented. So it's a question for each of you. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll try to answer the procedural questions and with help from council if I get beyond my depth, which is likely. And then I think you may want to ask the tribal representatives about the architectural design and how, if that's incorporated in the ordinance. But and first of all, the ordinance is a part of the submittal, and it indicates the tribe's intent to build the development as described here in the consistency determination. And we certainly believe that they'll follow through on that. We have no reason to think otherwise. But there is a provision. It is possible if there are additional impacts or changes to the project that the commission can reopen the federal consistency review. There also will be perhaps other federal consistency actions that may be needed. The tribe has mentioned that some of the development may need funding from a federal government source. The decision of the federal agency to fund is subject to consistency review by the commission as well.
I think the ordinance was really a good step. That was the compromise we agreed on when we were talking about some sort of continuing jurisdiction by the commission, and that ran contrary to the protection of the sovereignty of the tribe. And we respect that and understand that. And so I thought this was a really good solution to it. So we feel confident that what's being proposed is going to be provided. And as Bob says, if there are significant changes, then the federal consistency can be reopened. But in terms of the architectural component, you might want to ask a representative of the Rancheria about how that's guaranteed. I mean, it is a very attractive architectural style, and it's something that really adds to the aesthetics of the area. So.
Russ Crabtree, Tribal Administrator again. One of the CCNRs of the tribe, we can provide those to the Coastal Commission, so you should see that. Also, and it is a draft ordinance, like any other state or local agency that enacts a ordinance that becomes the guiding document for future activities. It goes through a review process. The tribe sets out, we have a 90-day review process that normally takes about 120 days before an ordinance is enacted, so there wasn't time to enact the ordinance before we came to the Coastal Commission meeting. So we would be willing to add a clause in there that we will comply with the tribe's CCNRs, its convinced constrictions for development. Okay?
Yeah, thank you. I think the design is very beautiful, and I think it really assists us, or me in particular, in making the finding under the visual resources policy. So that's why I was trying to make the connection. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I just would add, any development that the tribe has done, both in the past and in the future, meets the same architectural standards. In fact, that is what all future development will be. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner McClure.
Yes, I would like to move that the commission concur with the BIA's consistency determination, CD063-10, that the project described therein is fully consistent and thus is consistent to the maximum extent practicable with the enforcement policies of the California Coastal Commission program, the CCMP.
I'd like to second that.
Oh, sorry. And I urge that the commission vote yes.
I'd like to second that.
It's been seconded by Commissioner McClure it's been moved by Commissioner McClure and seconded by Commissioner Stewart. Would you like to speak to your motion?
I certainly would. That's my first motion since I've been a coastal commissioner.
It was very well done.
So.
Very well done.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I would like to say a couple of things about the Talawa people and the Smith River Rancheria in particular, that there is great strength in their tribal unity, and unlike many tribes in California, they have managed to hold the culture together even after one of the largest genocides in American history happened in my community, and the tribe has healed and is moving on from that, and their strength is wonderful to watch, and the buildings are their almost like their brand of their signature. The health clinic is the same. And the Smith River Rancheria is humbling itself when it talks about serving its community, because they have built an incredible community center. They have a health center. They have Head Start. They're putting their resources into their people, and kids are coming back from college, and it's a remarkable thing to see. From when I was raised in the community, there was such an incredible struggle happening, and the Smith River Rancheria is just pulling itself up. And so I'm very proud to live in the same community as the Smith River Rancheria and the Talawa people.
Commissioner Stewart, would you like to speak to your second?
I just would ditto everything Martha said, and also just add that I'm thrilled with the community serving facility. There is desperately a need for such a facility in that region, and I do a lot of health work, and there's a lot of need for that convenience store in that community. And it's just a wonderful project. They are a wonderful tribe to work with. They are very willing to work with agencies and in the community, and wholeheartedly support this project.
Commissioner Gurney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From Commissioner McClure's comments, I think perhaps you are too modest, and I want to congratulate you on your success. I'll be supporting the motion. I just had one comment for your consideration in the neighborhood design. It looks from the paperwork that we have that the neighborhood's exit onto Ocean Avenue in the convenience service center is on Highway 101. These are cul-de-sacs that go exit easterly, and I would
recommend that you connect internally with pathways or some access that's not car dependent so that folks can get to their store through the properties in a way that they don't have to drive all the way around, because it looks like it's a pretty short distance. And being on foot, being out in the neighborhood, I think will just enhance the community experience, making people visible and accessible to each other. So that's just a small land use concern I have in my recommendation to you in the design. Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Bloom.
Thank you. I really just want to echo the feelings of my fellow commissioners and say that this is an inspiring project, partly because of the place that it comes from in the heart of a community. I was surprised to see that there's a post office listed there, because I think it takes an act from a very high source to get a post office located in a community today, where in a time when the U.S. Postal Service is removing facilities and boxes in many of our local communities. So congratulations on that. But on a more serious note, I didn't ask a question about it, but I would hope and presume that the project will include as many elements of sustainability as possible. It looks like certainly on the waterfront you're doing a lot, but on energy efficiency and other important sustainability goals, I hope that that you'll incorporate them in. It certainly would seem to me that it fits within the mission and ethos of the nation that you would do those things. So congratulations to you. I do take Commissioner McClure's comments to heart that you're coming from a very negative place in the chapter of in the history of your nation, and that this is one very, very positive step in moving things forward.
Thank you. Any unwillingness to vote? Any unwillingness for a unanimous yes vote? Seeing none, the commission hereby concurs with the Bureau of Indian Affairs Consistency Determination, CD-063-10, and finds that the project described is fully consistent with the Coastal Act. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that brings us to the enforcement report and enforcement items. So let me turn it over to Lisa Hege.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Chair. The next item is item 7, the enforcement report for the June 2011 hearing. For today's enforcement report, I am going to discuss recent developments in four cases that reflect the variety of the work of the Enforcement Division and provide some examples to you of enforcement actions resolving violations at an informal level at the district level without requiring a formal order to come to you for a hearing. These were resolved in part due to the violator's agreement to resolve the violations relatively quickly and represent a bulk of the enforcement work done statewide. The first case, which comes out of our South Central District Office, involves the placement of unpermitted private no parking signs in the city right-of-way in the city of Ventura. Next slide. In late April 2011, Commission staff observed a worker digging what appeared to be holes for a fence on public property at the very western end of Main Street in the city of Ventura. Since this is a popular place for the public to park in order to access the beach at nearby Emma Woods State Park, we were naturally concerned that the beach access would be affected. Enforcement staff asked the worker what he was doing and was told that the owner of an adjacent private campground had hired him to install the no parking signs. Commission staff immediately contacted Caltrans, who we believed owned the property, and also the city of Ventura, in whose district jurisdiction we believed the property was located. Both the city and Caltrans were cooperative, but enough time elapsed that the work was completed and the no parking signs on the 6-inch steel posts set in concrete were already installed. This slide shows some of the posts and signs indicated by the red arrows on this shot, which is looking west. Next slide. This picture shows the area of the signs looking east, and you can see how large they are by the person standing next to it for scale. This slide is a close-up of the sign and the post. Subsequently, Caltrans mapping staff and surveyors determined that part of the property is owned by Caltrans, but that the posts and signs were located in a former Caltrans right-of-way that was acquired by the city when it was incorporated. Commission staff met with Caltrans and the city at the site, and the city agreed that the signs were placed in their right-of-way. The city sent a notice of violation to the individual who placed the signs with a short deadline for a removal. Next slide. When the signs were not removed by the deadline, the city painted them over as an interim measure to restore access to the area. And you can see the painted over view in this sign. Slide. Next slide. Finally, on June 9th, 2011, a city crew removed the signs and the beach parking was fully restored. Slide 7 is a photo of the city removing the signs. This next slide, slide 8, is a view west of the signs removed. And slide 9 is a photograph of the stretch of coast at Emma Wood State Park, which is again once accessible from the unrestricted parking area shown on the previous slides. Next slide. The next three cases arise out of the South Coast District, and the first one involves a staircase in Three Arch Bay. Next slide. In Laguna Beach, a decrepit and often impassable public access stairway to the beach at Brook Street has been rebuilt to provide public access using funds derived in part from an enforcement action. This photo is a view of the old staircase designated here by the red arrow, which clearly presented a hazardous situation with a drop which was scoured away at the end of the stairs and had waves running up to the base. Next slide. The case began with staff's discovery of ongoing unpermitted replacement of a bluff staircase at a pre-coastal gated community. This is the staircase under construction as staff discovered it. Enforcement staff requested that the construction of the staircase halt in order for staff and the community association to work together on a resolution. Pursuant to the Coastal Act, as you may know, public access to the coast must be provided with new development of this type, including replacement activity. Since the staircase here connected to a pre-coastal gated community, even allowing public access to these stairs would not actually result in any increased public access. Thus, as a condition of the coastal development permit authorizing the reconstruction of the stairs, the community association contributed $50,000 to the city's rebuilding of the public staircase to the popular public Brooks Street beach. Next slide. In this photo, you can see the rebuilt staircase, again designated by the red arrow, with the base angled away from run-up and thus providing a nice sandy landing for the public to use. Slide 14. As you can see in this slide, the staircase also includes a beach shower, benches, and viewing platform. Next slide. This is a view of the heavily used Brook Street Beach with the new staircase in the foreground. Next slide. The next case involves removal of ESHA, Environmentally Sensitive Habitat Area, and the building of a road through habitat for several endangered plant and wildlife species. Next slide. In Dana Point, a developer built out a utility easement that runs through a public park that was designated as ESHA by the Coastal Commission. It was designated as ESHA due to the presence of the federally listed endangered Pacific pocket mouse and federally listed threatened coastal California gnatcatcher, as well as a rare protected succulent, the Plaquemines dudleya. The road is indicated on this aerial by the red arrow. In this photo, you can see the built-out easement road running from a hotel site to a subdivision, both of which were approved via a local CDP permit. Development of the easement road, however, was not authorized by the CDP. The road was actually located within Hilltop Park, which had been restored with coastal sage scrub pursuant to the same CDP that authorized the hotel and subdivision development. Slide 18. This photo is an overview of the restoration work done within Hilltop Park with coastal sage scrub established down to the bluff edge in the background. Next slide. This slide shows the contrast from the undisturbed and contiguous sage scrub on the previous slide. This photo is of the unpermitted road at issue at this violation, which bifurcated habitat as well as obviously precludes habitat establishment within the roadbed itself and the side castings. Construction of this road consistent with the protected habitat area was completely inconsistent. Construction within a protected habitat area was completely inconsistent with the LCP, Coastal Act, and local CDP. Upon discovering the unpermitted road, commission staff requested that the developer restore the area to coastal sage scrub pursuant to the approved restoration plan for the area. Next slide. Replanting of the road site with native coastal sage scrub plant species is underway. In this photo, you can see that the road site is starting to blend with the surrounding vegetation and hopefully will soon provide uninterrupted habitat for protected species such as the pocket mouse and California gnatcatcher. Next slide. This is a picture of the Pacific pocket mouse. This slide was taken by a researcher studying the mouse at nearby Camp Pendleton, which is one of the other very few places besides Hilltop Park that supports the Pacific pocket mouse. Next slide. The last case is also from the South Coast District, arising in Corona del Mar. Next slide. Staff received a report from the California State Parks that a cell phone tower had been installed just inland from the coast. A state park and the restored cottages at Crystal Cove State Park Historic District and seaward of the heavily traveled Pacific Coast Highway. You can see it marked with the red arrow. The tower was installed on a bluff top where thousands of daily commuters, recreators, sightseers, and beachgoers are afforded expansive views of the ocean, state park, and cottages, as you see here. Because of the unblemished scenic resources along this stretch of coast, the City of Newport Beach LCP designates this area as visually significant land. Clearly, the placement of a cell phone tower here is inconsistent with the visual resource protection policies of the LCP and Coastal Act. After discovery, staff directed the cell phone company that installed the pole to remove it, which, as you can see in the next photo...
Hang on. Before you move on to the next photo, I just want to point out to the commission that this is Crystal Cove State Park. These are the cottages that are being restored for lower cost overnight accommodations. And in the Golden Shores Hotel project that you dealt with, or the project you dealt with yesterday, if the city of Long Beach doesn't use funds, this is where they're going to go to complete. It won't be enough money to complete it all, but once it's completed, all of these cottages will be available, and they're really fantastic and low cost. So this is a remarkable project the commission made possible.
Indeed. Next slide. And here's the denouement with the cell phone tower removed. Next slide. As a result, passersby can now enjoy unfettered views such as this. I wanted to note that all three of these cases were handled by our intrepid Long Beach enforcement staffer, Andrew Willis, who is also here today and does wonderful work on behalf of the commission. Intrepid. He's many other things, but he is definitely intrepid. And thank you. Okay, that includes the enforcement report for this month. We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioner Mitchell has a question for you.
How does a cell phone tower get built there? It just is baffling to me. Who was the cell phone company? And, the cell phone companies do this. I mean, having sat on a local planning agency for the city, I mean, all the cell phone towers go through the planning process. And, you know, I just don't know how that could happen.
Well, Andrew can give you the details about that. I don't know the company that put it in. In general, though, you would be amazed at all the unpermitted development that happens up and down the coast. The cell phone tower is actually, you know, relatively small and quick to put up. Mm-hmm. We find entire houses and all sorts, roads, you name it, built without any permits. And sometimes we find them and sometimes we don't. But it's just, it's amazing. But do you want to address the specifics?
Well, the tower was installed by a cell phone company, NextG. I think they're coming from a perspective of covering gaps in their service without a lot of interest or acknowledgement of the resources we're protecting. Once we contacted them and let them know this was a visually important area, they removed the pole fairly quickly.
But they didn't receive any permits, I mean, either coastal permits or local government permits.
I'm not entirely sure which permits they would need from the local government, but they certainly did not receive a coastal development permit.
But you would need something from the locals as well. I mean, those have to go through regular permitting process. So.
Yeah, presumably. And if we think something is retainable, then we look into whether there were local permits. When it's inconsistent with the Coastal Act and unpermitted, we can take
it down,
get it removed.
Good job.
Any thanks.
Once again.
The next enforcement items are items 7.1, Commission Cease and Desist Order CCC 11CD04 Campbell, and Commission Restoration Order Number CCC 11RO03 Campbell. As noted on today's agenda, there's one staff report for both items, and both items will be addressed in the presentation.
Thank you.
Chair Schellenberg, we're ready to have you announce the matter.
Yes, I am. The item before us is CCC-11-CD-04 and CCC-11-RO-03. At this time, I'd like to ask, are the alleged violators or their representatives present? And if so, would they please come to the mic and identify themselves?
Morning. Michael Schiller, S-C-H-I-L-L-E-R, on behalf of Michelle Campbell.
Thank you. That's fine for now. Thank you. Staff, could you please indicate what matters are already a part of the record?
Yes. The record consists of the staff report for this matter and its attachments, the public records and the violation permit files referenced in the staff report and today's presentation. We note that there is an addendum for this matter, which is also part of the record, which includes a number of letters of support for the staff recommendation in this matter and that was previously distributed to commissioners.
Thank you. Just to double check, were there any ex parte communications to disclose on this? Good. We are not supposed to do them. It's just worth double checking in case somebody does. So first of all, I'll set the time limits. Let's see. Staff, how much time would you like for your presentation?
Since this is a contested matter, we need to have a full hearing, and we'll take approximately 20 minutes.
20 minutes, fine. So the staff will have 20 minutes, and the alleged violators will also have 20 minutes. The members of the public after that will be given 3 minutes apiece. Now, I just have to, this is an unusual procedure, so I'm going to announce how it works. Questions can be posed in writing or proposed orally to the commission. Commissioners have the discretion to ask the proposed questions or not. Questions are directed at anyone other than the person who proposes them, and questions must be proposed before the public hearing is closed. So having said that, I will open the public hearing and ask staff for their presentation.
Thank you. I just wanted to make one note. Andrew Willis, again, the same intrepid staffer, is the Long Beach district staff who was the original lead in this matter and worked on the matter for a number of years prior to this point. Then it was elevated to the headquarters staff, and Eli Davidian, who's the headquarters enforcement staff, will present the staff report for this matter. Senior staff counsel Alex Helperin is also available for any questions you might have of a legal nature. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. I'll now begin the staff presentation. Staff recommends that you issue the proposed cease and desist and restoration orders to resolve violations on property located at 433 Paseo de la Playa in the city of Torrance, Los Angeles County, and hereafter referred to as the subject property. Current property owner Michelle Campbell and her ex-husband and former co-owner William Campbell, hereafter referred to as respondents, are the persons subject to these proceedings. The violations at issue include development that is both unpermitted and inconsistent with numerous conditions of a commission-issued coastal development permit, or CDP, and its amendments. Because respondents had joint ownership and control over the property at the time of these violations and have joint responsibility for undertaking the actions at issue, they are jointly responsible under the Coastal Act. Slide 2. The approximate location of the subject property is shown here. As you can see, it's located approximately 3 miles south of the Redondo Beach King Harbor Marina and 1/2 mile north of the Palos Verdes Peninsula. The commission has jurisdiction here because there's no certified local coastal program for this area. Slide 3. This 2010 aerial photograph shows the subject property in the context of the Torrance Coastal Bluff and Beach Park. With a few exceptions, most of the development along the bluff is confined to its top, leaving the bluff face mostly undeveloped. The coastal dune and bluff scrub growing in the area provides food and cover for a number of special status species, including the El Segundo blue butterfly, which is formally listed by the federal government as endangered. The butterfly is extremely dependent on coast buckwheat for survival. Coast buckwheat is a native perennial species that is perhaps most easily identified by its white or pink flowers that cluster to form a ball-shaped flower head. The butterfly larvae feed on these flower heads, pupate directly beneath the plant, and the adults use the flower heads to perch, mate, feed, and lay eggs. Slide 4. The bluff face also serves as a buffer between private bluff top development and Torrance Public Beach at its base, and thus provides a more natural, secluded beach experience than is typical for Los Angeles County beaches. Consequently, it's a critical component of the unique character of this beach. Slide 5. The activities at issue in this matter, some of which are shown here, include, but are not limited to, failure to comply with multiple conditions of a CDP, including those requiring implementation of the El Segundo Blue Butterfly Habitat Restoration Plan on the bluff face, and that plan is shown here on the left. Planting of non-native vegetation in the habitat restoration area. Grading and construction of two concrete patios in the habitat restoration area. Grading and construction of an 8-foot-tall retaining wall along the bluff toe in the habitat restoration area. Construction of two cabana-like shade structures atop the concrete patios in the habitat restoration area. Construction of a separate, approximately 8-foot-tall wall along the property's western boundary adjacent to Torrance Beach in the area for which the commission limited any such wall to 4 feet. And failure to comply with a permit condition requiring commission review of all development not authorized under the original permit. Slide 6. These activities cause damage to coastal resources afforded protection under the Coastal Act, including but not limited to an area previously identified by the commission as environmentally sensitive habitat for an endangered El Segundo blue butterfly, which is shown here. This species of butterfly is critically endangered. Its global range is limited to just the dunes and bluffs around El Segundo that support the butterfly's host plant, the coast buckwheat. Prior to these violations, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and commission staff had confirmed the presence of the butterfly and its host plant on the subject property. Slide 7. The next few slides include a brief summary of a rather lengthy history of relevant commission actions concerning the property. A more detailed account is provided in pages 9 through 13 of the staff report. In 1991, the commission granted to respondent's predecessor a permit for construction of a single-family residence on the bluff top. Approval was subject to several conditions, including special condition number 5, which required commission approval for any future development. A minor amendment was approved in 1993. After initial grading of the building pad, development ceased for a couple of years. Inadequate drainage of the incomplete project caused significant erosion impacts to the site. Lender Hawthorne Savings acquired the property and attempted to address the erosion through placement of unpermitted development, including sandbags and other materials on the bluff face. In 1994, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contacted the commission to express concern over the state of the property and its impacts to the endangered butterfly and its habitat. This photo shows the subject property in 1995 and the results of the erosion and unpermitted development. To resolve the violation, in October of that year, Hawthorne sought CDP Amendment Number 2 for, among other things, implementation of a bluff restoration plan. The Fish and Wildlife Service reviewed the plan and determined that, if implemented, the plan would restore habitat for the El Segundo blue butterfly. In November of that year, the amendment application was transferred to respondents who had recently taken title to the property. Slide 9. To obtain the approvals sought in the application for Amendment Number 2, respondents signed an affidavit stating that they understood the requirements of the original CDP, its limitations on future development, and accepted the obligations of the CDP and requirements to correct Coastal Act violations. The affidavit signed by respondents is shown here, and it's included as Exhibit 9 of the staff report for these proceedings. Slide 10. In April of 1996, the Commission issued to respondents CDP Amendment Number 2, which required implementation of the Habitat Restoration Plan and annual monitoring of its progress for at least 5 years. That same month, the Commission issued two subsequent immaterial amendments, Numbers 3 and 4. The former granted approval for, among other development, a 4-foot-tall property boundary wall at the toe of the bluff. The Commission found the boundary wall, limited to the 4-foot height proposed, to be compatible with the character of other walls in the immediate area and conducive to the restoration of the bluff. Slide 11. This photo was taken by Commission permit staff in 2001 for a permit matter concerning an adjacent property. It was rediscovered in the course of enforcement staff's investigation for this matter. At the date of this image, According to the terms of Amendment Number 2, the restoration effort, including the planting of 200 coast buckwheat for the endangered butterfly, should have been in its fifth of a five-year monitoring program. However, in February of 2003, enforcement staff confirmed that respondents had failed to implement the required restoration plan or submit any of the required monitoring reports, and instead placed a substantial amount of unpermitted development, including structures and ornamental vegetation, in the habitat restoration area. Staff later discovered that respondents had constructed a separate 8-foot-tall boundary wall in the area for which Amendment Number 3 limited a wall to 4 feet. Slide 12. In April 2003, staff mailed to respondents a notice of violation letter explaining the requirements of the CDP and the Coastal Act and the measures necessary to resolve these violations. Between 2003 and 2011, staff would send 7 such notices. The Campbells responded by submitting an application for CDP Amendment Number 5, seeking after-the-fact approval of everything except the boundary wall and non-native landscaping. At its August 2005 meeting, the Commission denied the application for Amendment Number 5 and rejected respondents' subsequent request for reconsideration at its November 2005 meeting. The Commission's decision in both instances was based on its findings that the development is inconsistent with numerous Coastal Act resource protection policies. Slide 13. In February of 2006, apparently in response to staff's fifth notice of violation letter, respondents submitted an incomplete application for a 6th CDP amendment, this one for authorization to remove the unpermitted structures previously denied and restore the property. Despite staff's request for additional materials necessary to process the application, respondents never completed the application, and finally staff returned the incomplete application materials in June of 2009. In 2007, respondents divorced, and Michelle Campbell was awarded the subject property. However, because respondents are jointly responsible for the violations, staff continued its efforts to resolve this matter with each individually. And unfortunately, those efforts were unsuccessful. And so after several years of attempts to work with respondents to resolve the violations, in spring of 2010, staff mailed to respondents letters notifying them of its intent to commence formal order proceedings. And in Ms. Campbell's case, to record a notice of violation, or NOVA, on the property's title. The letters included dates by which respondents were to submit defenses, and in Ms. Campbell's case, to object to the recordation of a NOVA. Staff received no response. And so April of that year recorded a notice of violation on the property's title. Slide 14. In the ensuing months, staff continued with informal efforts to reach agreement with respondents. Again, these efforts were unsuccessful. In April of this year, staff provided respondents with one final opportunity to resolve this matter amicably. We received no response. As such, there's no further administrative option other than to proceed with the proposed cease and desist and restoration orders. Slide 15. Authority for the Commission's issuance of the proposed orders is provided in Coastal Act Sections 30810 and 30811. Section 30810 provides for the issuance of a cease and desist order when the Commission finds that the development has occurred without a CDP or in violation of a previously issued CDP. Similarly, Section 30811 provides for the issuance of a restoration order when the Commission finds that development has occurred without a CDP, is inconsistent with the Coastal Act, and is causing continuing resource damage, as I'll briefly discuss in the next few slides, and as presented more fully in pages 13 through 20 of the staff report. Each of these standards has been met in this case. Slide 17. The Coastal Act specifies that any person wishing to undertake development in the coastal zone must first obtain a CDP. Development is defined broadly under the Coastal Act in order to best protect coastal resources. As illustrated in the photographs at the beginning of this presentation, the actions here qualify as development under many of these terms. The development was undertaken without the necessary permits and in violation of a CDP and its amendments, and therefore the first standard for the Commission's issuance of the proposed orders has been met. Slide 18. As described on pages 15 through 19 of the staff report, the development at issue is inconsistent with numerous Coastal Act resource protection policies. A few examples are discussed in the following slides. In listing the El Segundo blue butterfly, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service noted or warned that Any future development on these few remaining sites could well bring the species to extinction because of its importance as a primary habitat for the El Segundo blue butterfly. The commission has previously found areas of the torrents, coastal bluffs that support coast buckwheat to be environmentally sensitive habitat areas. Shown on the right, the required habitat restoration plan called for the planting of 200 coast buckwheat among other coastal scrub plants. And for your reference, the required coast buckwheat are represented by small circles in the areas shaded green in the image to the right. However, the development performed by respondents, which was not resource dependent, including the planting of non-native species and the construction of numerous structures in the bluff face, failed to protect this butterfly's habitat and therefore is inconsistent with Section 30240A. Slide 19. Moreover, respondents' maintenance of the unpermitted development within the habitat restoration area, as shown in this 2010 photograph, is incompatible with the continuance of the butterfly habitat by virtue of displacement, but also because the development precludes both passive restoration and implementation of the required habitat restoration plan, and therefore is inconsistent with Section 30240B. Slide 20. Noted previously, the Commission limited the boundary wall to 4 feet, finding a wall of such height would conform to the character of the area and be compatible with other walls in the immediate area. However, respondents constructed a wall of approximately 8 feet, backfilled the area behind the wall, and constructed a concrete patio atop the fill. And you'll note the white patio furniture to the right of this photograph demonstrates the height of the fill behind the wall. Respondents' actions failed to protect, enhance, or ensure compatibility with the visual quality of the area, are inconsistent with the specific requirements of the permit, and therefore are inconsistent with Section 30251. Slide 21. In its 2005 decision denying respondents' request for Amendment Number 5, the Commission found the development to be inconsistent with numerous Coastal Act policies, as shown in this slide. For these reasons, the second standard for the Commission's issuance of the proposed orders has been met. Subject development has altered the natural topography of the bluff, its vegetative composition, and habitat function for an endangered species, and has degraded the visual quality of the coastal bluffs immediately adjacent to the public beach, among other impacts, thereby causing damage to coastal resources. The photograph in the slide shows portions of the subject property in 2010. The development at issue, including structures and non-native vegetation, remain on the property today in the habitat restoration area. Without restoration, revegetation, and careful monitoring, impacts to coastal resources will persist, including the continuation of the damage noted previously, but also the temporal loss of the native plant community that comprises the Esha, the prevention of its natural return, and the resulting impacts to the El Segundo blue butterfly and other species. The persistence of these impacts constitutes continuing resource damage, and therefore the last standard has been satisfied for the Commission's issuance of the proposed orders. Slide 23. Staff mailed statement of defense forms with its 2010 notice of intent letters. This is the administrative procedure specified in the regulations for respondents to raise issues for the commission to consider. Respondents never submitted any defenses. Nonetheless, as a courtesy, we address some of the general claims raised by respondents over the past several years. At the center of these claims are three main objections concerning liability, knowledge of the violation, and permit compliance. Slide 24. William Campbell has claimed that the court, during the Campbell divorce proceedings, devalued his assets to compensate for Michelle Campbell taking sole responsibility for the Coastal Act violations. The Commission has on numerous occasions invited Mr. Campbell to submit any information that might substantiate this assertion. He's provided none. However, even if his assertion were true, the court's devaluation of Mr. Campbell's assets would neither resolve his responsibility under the Coastal Act nor bar the Commission from issuing the proposed orders to resolve Coastal Act violations. Based on the information presented by respondents, the Commission concludes that the Court's decision did not address or resolve Coastal Act violations at issue. Slide 25. In a 2003 letter, respondents claimed that they had no knowledge of the violations on the site and thought the Commission would be contacting them regarding the bluff slope restoration. The Commission notes that a violator's knowledge of the violation's existence is not a prerequisite for the Commission's issuance of the order. Moreover, the record in this case does not support respondents' claim. First, as shown on an earlier slide, Mr. Campbell signed an affidavit stating that he understood and accepted the development limitations of the CDP. And in subsequent letters, he stated as much and referred specifically to the specific conditions calling for restoration. And for these reasons, the Commission rejects Mr. Campbell's assertion that respondents had no knowledge of the violations at issue. Slide 26. Lastly, in October of 2003, respondents arborist Rick Wheeler mailed to the Commission a letter stating that the restoration of the bluff area had been accomplished pursuant to the 96 permit. The objectives to which he refers included restoration of the bluff face, including the planting of the buckwheat, submittal of annual monitoring reports for at least 5 years from the date of issuance of the permit, and the success criteria included the establishment of at least 140 coast buckwheat plants by the end of the monitoring period or 2001. The Commission received no evidence of the restoration plan implementation, none of the required monitoring plans or reports, and no evidence of a viable community of 140 coast buckwheat. Counter to Mr. Wheeler's assertion that the restoration had been completed by 2003, and as evidenced by the photographs in this slide, the Commission found that respondents had not implemented the plan, but instead constructed several unpermitted structures in the restoration area and planted the remainder with ornamental species. For these reasons, the Commission rejects Mr. Wheeler's assertion that the restoration objectives had been achieved. Slide 28. To resolve these violations, staff proposes the issuance of the cease and desist and restoration orders. The proposed orders would require respondents to cease and desist from undertaking any further unpermitted development, remove all unpermitted development, undertake restoration and mitigation to address impacts of the endangered butterfly and its habitat, remove all non-native and invasive species from the area, monitor the success of the restoration for a period of not less than 5 years. In conclusion, staff recommends that the Commission issue the proposed cease and desist and restoration orders. The proposed orders provide a framework for resolving these violations, relieving their associated impacts to an endangered species and its habitat, and restoring these coastal resources in a timely fashion. And that concludes staff presentation, and we're happy to answer any questions that you may have at this time. And I'll just also note that there are two motions for this matter, and they're found on pages 6 and 7 of the staff report.
Thank you. Now I'll call up the alleged violator or representative, and you'll have 20 minutes.
Michael Schiller again on behalf of Michelle Campbell.
Hold on. We'll get this mastered in a minute. Let's get this clock before you begin. Yes. All right. Thank you.
Michael Schiller on behalf of Michelle Campbell. Basically, we're not here to make arguments with respect to the violations. We're here basically to show that Michelle Campbell does care. You'll note that Willie Campbell's not here. The divorce has been pending for years. William Campbell's the one that signed the document that you've seen in evidence. William Campbell's also the one who's the developer and contractor. Our goal today is to try to get this thing resolved. And we've already discussed it with staff, and hopefully we'll be having a meeting on Monday to try to get it resolved through the resources Michelle has available. Understand that Michelle has filed a bankruptcy. It's being converted to a Chapter 11 and through the bankruptcy. The goal is to try to get the property sold, get it repaired to meet your requirements, and hopefully the new owner will be able to comply with your request. That's it.
Thank you very much. Penny Alia, 3 minutes.
Thank you. I agree with Commissioner Mitchell when you ask how do these things happen, and this is noncompliance with conditions similar to what I was speaking to you about earlier this morning. And, you know, we're talking about finite resources here. Finite. This is an endangered species on the verge of extinction. So when we hear about the devaluation of the property, I'd like to talk about the devaluation of our finite coastal resources when we're nearing extinction of a species. continuing causing resource damage. But I think it's going to be very important. It's wonderful to hear that Mrs. Campbell or Ms. Campbell is moving towards some sort of resolve on this, but it's going to be very important that there's a qualified restoration specialist, whoever Mr. Wheeler is and whatever his lack of qualifications or ability to give a truthful monitoring report. I think it's going to be very important that Ms. Campbell find the proper restoration specialist for this. And I think you probably better understand why I kind of keep my parking issue over to the side, given the destruction of resources that are going on up and down the coast. But certainly after staff's presentation, you see that we have an ongoing problem in the South Coast District, and that question continues to be asked is, how do these things happen? And that's why it's so important to have the public involved in enforcement issues, to support staff and to bring these things to your knowledge, because otherwise staff can't be everywhere all the time. And we appreciate the intrepid Andrew Willis and all that he does, and we appreciate all that you do to uphold the Coastal Act and protect and preserve our finite coastal resources. And I ask you to support staff today and see if we can't get this restoration going and save this species. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia Hanscom.
Honorable Commissioners, Marcia Hanscom with the Coastal Law Enforcement Action Network, CLEAN. And I'm also co-director of the Biona Institute, which has been very concerned about the El Segundo blue butterfly. And in fact, we are growing coast buckwheat in a native plant nursery for a restoration in a part of the city-owned Biona wetlands area. And so we know very well how challenging it is to make sure that the habitat for this butterfly is even appropriate. And what I was struck by in those photos, looking at that very, very first photo when the original permit was granted, was just the stark distinction between the really mostly open sandy bluff originally, which is what you want to have for the kinds of habitat that this species needs, and what is there today. I mean, I think that they not only, the applicants here and subjects of this order are not only failed to protect the habitat, but really obliterated it. And probably there's a Federal Endangered Species Act violation here as well. And it would seem to me that there will be the Fish and Wildlife Service, and restoring this habitat will also include the need to bring back this butterfly as well. I mean, I don't even know if it's still there given the state of the property. But I would like to say how when enforcement issues, in my experience watching this commission, enforcement issues do not rise to this occasion where you have this kind of a contested cease and desist order unless there has been really repeated, egregious, just really flagrant dismissal of the permit and of the enforcement staff and their requirements. They are very, very patient. They work, as you heard by Ms. Hagee, they work regularly to try and get enforcement issues resolved without getting to this point. You heard about several other ones where they never had to come to this point. So when something comes to you in this manner, it's, I think, really a pretty easy decision for you, and I urge you to support the staff in requiring this cease and desist order be made clear so that the legal remedies are there in case something doesn't happen next Monday when the respondents come in and it doesn't get to where everyone would hope it would be. I think you really do have to vote to approve what the staff originally recommended here. Thank you.
Thank you. Robert Vanderhoek.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mary Schallenberger, and commissioners.
My name is Robert Roy Vanderhoek, and I am a biologist and representing Bione Institute and Coastal Law Enforcement Action Network, CLEAN. And I have worked in this area as a biologist for more than 11 years now, and have visited this site at that time 11 years ago and several times since then. And what I'd like to do in my time here is talk briefly a little bit about the ecology and the history of the Endangered Species Act and how it relates to this butterfly and its habitat. If the Endangered Species Act hadn't been passed in 1973-72 time period, we would not have that butterfly on the endangered species list, of course. 4 years after the law was passed, 1976, it was placed on the endangered species list because also a specialist lepidopterist named Rudy Mattoni had worked on the taxonomy and identified it as a unique and different butterfly amongst the hundreds that we have in our state of different types of butterflies. And that's what's a remarkable wealth of biodiversity wealth in our state is we have a unique a region in our North American continent with California and especially along the coast. So after it's recognized as endangered, it forced Chevron at the El Segundo refinery where it had a population to save the butterfly, and they did a campaign to commercials and everything, Chevron Cares, and that was part of an agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do that. At Los Angeles Airport, the other known population would have been eliminated because a golf course was in the works by Los Angeles Airport and the city of Los Angeles. So both an airport and an oil refinery were stopped, and the species didn't go extinct. Then we discovered that this butterfly had a third location where this in violation is occurred. And so there are only three locations now, and they're all precarious, and they're all on the edge of being able to continue in perpetuity, which is what the law says and the Endangered Species Act says. I think a jeopardy opinion is called for here, and I'd like to see the commission and the excellent enforcement staff, Andrew Willis, work with the federal government to pursue that further. And we need to get to a goal under the Endangered Species Act law states. You want to get to somewhere between 6 to 12 locations for the butterfly. So we're only at 3.
Thank you. Excuse me, staff, do you have a need for a rebuttal?
Not a rebuttal, but we could clarify a couple of things quickly. We appreciate the expressed cooperation of Ms. Campbell's representatives and look forward to working with her. We know Mr. Campbell is not here. Secondly, one of the commenters urged that we have a required a qualified restoration specialist. The order does require that that the qualifications for the specialist be submitted, and they're subject to review by our staff biologist and approval by the executive director. And thirdly, I just wanted to clarify that the meeting that he referenced Monday that we're hoping to have with Ms. Campbell and her representatives is, the staff intends that to be a meeting regarding compliance with this order, not a substitute for issuance of the order, just if there was a question about that. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I will come back to the commission for deliberation. Commissioner Bojko.
Because I am new, I have two questions for staff. One is, if these orders are approved, what remedies does that give us that we didn't have before in terms of enforcing the permit? And what effect does this bankruptcy have on whatever we decide here today?
Under the Coastal Act, there are penalties that lie as a result of original Coastal Act violations, and there are also additional penalties for failure to comply with an order. So that if enforcement were required later in a penalty framework, it would allow us to enforce the compliance with the order. Permits themselves and a lot of the work that's required under this order was also required by the original permit, but they're not self-enforcing. They're volitional
documents obtained by applicants, but there's nothing in them that self-compels compliance unless we take an enforcement action.
I understand, but once the if the order is given for restoration, does that give you, is there an injunction? Is there some legal remedy that you have that will force them then to comply with what they haven't complied with before?
We can go into court with the work of our Attorney General to enforce the terms of the order, and we do and have done that. Okay. And it's just easier to enforce because the terms are clearly set forth and the findings that the Commission makes are useful in that litigation. I don't know if Jamie wants to...
Yes, also because the Commission will have made a decision, an administrative decision, someone objecting to it, the alleged violator, would have to file a lawsuit within 60 days. If they do not file and they do not challenge it, it is a res judicata, it is binding on them, and the court would have to enforce it. It simply makes this Commission's job that much easier in litigation if we have to go to that point. And again, if they do violate the order once it's final, there are additional fines and penalties, so there's more incentive to actually comply with the order.
Okay, and the bankruptcy?
And the bankruptcy has no effect on the Commission's enforcement abilities. There is an automatic stay that applies in bankruptcy proceedings, but that stay does not apply to administrative agencies such as the Commission who exercise regulatory authority, which the Commission is doing in the context of a cease and desist order. So the bankruptcy at this point has no effect on your ability to issue this order.
But if there are penalties, are we just a creditor then?
I would note, just for the record, that only Ms. Campbell has filed bankruptcy.
And there are no penalties associated with... the proposed order that the staff is bringing to the Commission now doesn't involve the imposition of penalties. Penalties would be imposed through litigation subsequently.
Okay.
And I would just also note that Ms. Campbell's bankruptcy attorney is here as well and is in agreement.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Is in agreement with what?
Thank you. Commissioner Burke.
I think that Ms. Bosco was going down the right path. What's not clear to me is what happens in the real life situation. I know that the lawyers here work in their legal framework here, but while the grass is growing, the horse is starving and the butterflies dying, because we jam this woman who's in bankruptcy. She can't sell the house. It goes into foreclosure. The bank sure doesn't care about our order. So the situation just gets worse. And with the current inventory of foreclosed properties in Southern California, God knows when this thing gets corrected. So it's really, I obviously am going to support enforcement staff on this because it's a situation which calls for that. But the real life help for this butterfly is not in getting a piece of paper that says this woman needs to do this. It's getting it done. So what we, Lisa, you know I love you. You can figure it out. But what we really need to do is try and help restore this. If that's buckwheat plant is not that tough to come by. I mean, so that's really the answer to this, in addition to the fact that we need an administrative procedure to hold them responsible.
Commissioner Zimmer.
Madam Chair, I wanted to ask Ms. Patterson if her statement about the bankruptcy, the effect of the bankruptcy, applies equally to the foreclosure, if there is, because that footnote. There's a footnote or statement on page 19 indicating that the creditor notifying that she had filed for bankruptcy and stating their intent to foreclose upon the property. And does that create some kind of... I'm sorry. If, in fact, a foreclosure is initiated, does that create a need for additional or further action on the part of the Commission to try to deal with that?
No, I think at this point, if you issue the order, we'll be able to proceed to enforce it if we need to.
Thank you.
And if I could respond slightly on some of these points, this case is not as dark as it may appear from the facts. Because we filed a notice of violation on the property, any party who takes the property takes subject to that notice. And we have been aggressive in contacting all the potential persons who are ahead of us in the lien list to let them know and put them on notice of not just this order, but the Coastal Act and the permit requirements which run with the land. And so anybody who takes the property will be taking with notice, and that was another additional reason why we thought it was good to have the hearing today. In addition, they've all indicated that the value of the property here, luckily enough, is in well in excess of the costs of the restoration, probably also superior liens. So I think we're going to be in a good position here, and we're very pleased that Mrs. Campbell is willing to work with us to try to put the restoration in place. And we're actually, this is not just a Pyrrhic victory. We really do believe that this order could result in restoration of the site.
And I would just add to that that I think you mentioned this, but one of the lenders has already contacted us and expressed an interest if they are successful in foreclosing in working with us. Alternatively, another possible outcome is that Ms. Campbell retains the property through the bankruptcy because it's not a liquidation, it's a reorganization at this point. And the third possibility is that through the reorganization, she does transfer the property as her bankruptcy attorney has indicated she's interested in doing. But again, then she's transferring to somebody who has full notice of the order. So in any of those three scenarios, there is, we think, a reasonable possibility, and in fact a good likelihood, that the party who ends up with the property will be both aware of and cooperative in implementing the orders.
Commissioner Resnick.
I think I'll start with a motion just to get it moving, and then I'll have some comments on that and following up on Commissioner Burke. So I move that the Commission issue cease and desist order number CCC-11-CD-04 pursuant to the staff recommendation and recommend a yes vote.
I second.
It's been moved by Commissioner Resnick and seconded by Commissioner Bochco. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Yes. We get a lot of tough ones here. This one is not a tough one in terms of the vote, but it is a tough one, I think, in what Commissioner Burke and others have gotten to, which is, you know, I want to figure out how to get this done ASAP, and, you know, justice delayed is justice denied, and that is particularly acute in a case where you're talking about extremely sensitive habitat, you know, extremely endangered species that could be wiped out, and even the language of, you know, the paper will attach and whoever, and I recognize that. I mean, whoever's going to buy the house. I mean, just like when I had to buy a house, I had to get my electrical into compliance. I'd have to get this into compliance. I'm still hearing a lot of things that are a potential delay. And you've had folks, I'm very glad Ms. Campbell's here today, her representatives, and is willing to work and meet on Monday. I appreciate that Mr. Campbell is not in bankruptcy and maybe an easier way to go about this. But this has been going on forever and ever and ever. I mean, this is, what, well more than a decade and numerous violations. You know, frankly, if somebody is abusive to an animal, you go after a criminal case, and here you're looking at potentially wiping out an endangered species. If I had the authority, I would be looking at a court for criminal action. And so I just want to, with the strongest emphasis, and I know staff realizes this, and hopefully, this is as much for Ms. Campbell's representatives here, how much at least I myself and hopefully the rest of the commission are behind getting this moving as quickly, resolving it as quickly, and, you know, not getting papers and liens and high in order, but getting this thing restored as quickly as humanly possible. One last thing I want to kind of leave with, and it's, you know, it's a little bit of a soapbox, but, you know, we need to change our mindset in this you know, state and in this country and frankly on this planet on what what are priorities. I mean, here you have an opportunity on your property for having, you know, sort of an ultimate, you know, conversation piece, right? This beautiful habitat, this amazing butterfly. We all saw pictures. And here we could have had somebody take ownership and say, this is something, I mean, what pride to have in your property. And instead, you know, we can't appreciate the beauty of nature and our natural environment. We have to import natives and import all these things. And it really just shows, you know, frankly, kind of a screwed up mindset, and it's sad and unfortunate.
Commissioner Bochco, would you like to speak to your second?
No, I think Mr. Commissioner Resnick said it very well.
Thank you. Commissioner Burke.
I have a question for staff. Is there a what is the priority of our enforcement action? Is it to tear down walls or to improve the habitat?
Through the chair, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. It depends.
Well, let me explain myself a little bit better. This woman's lawyer stands up and says she has limited resources. So do we make her use those resources for tearing down the 8-foot wall to a 4-foot wall? Do we use her resources to take out palm trees, or do we use her resources that she has limited resources to put in buckwheat plant? It's kind of like Bruce was saying, what's our priority?
It's a bit of a Hobson's choice here, since both affect the habitat and both are violations of the Coastal Act. There was the slide that Mr. Davidian showed where the wall was supporting backfill, which was also supporting unpermitted development that was in part of the area that was meant to be habitat restoration. And the removal of the wall is not significantly expensive, especially since it can be cut down. So we were recommending that she comply, that the Campbells jointly comply with all of the Coastal Act violations on their site. However, just to respond to the bigger picture question, we have a very rigorous priorities process within the enforcement group. We realize that we are way too few for way too many violations, and we do have to do a lot of prioritizing, and things don't move as quickly, and we don't move as many violations as we'd like. However, we really do look at the effect to coastal resources as the very first sort that we do when we look at prioritizing, and that's why this case was brought to you today. We completely agree with you about the importance of this resource.
I don't want to prolong this, but I didn't hear what the priority was as it related to this butterfly in this case. Because the difference between a 4-foot and an 8-foot wall to a butterfly is not going to make any difference.
You know, if I could just say one thing here, I'm not sure we're faced with that choice at this point. I think it may be a false choice. The Ms. Campbell's representatives have not indicated that she won't be able to comply with both, and Mr. Campbell isn't in bankruptcy and may have plenty of resources to put towards this. Plus, the assessed value of the property indicates that there are millions of dollars in equity still on this property, and the assessment of the work needed to do to comply with the orders is well below that, orders of magnitude below that. So I'm not sure that choice is really before us, and we have to make that decision at this point.
If you're talking about assessed value in property, you're talking about a long-term situation, and it's marginal at best. You know, I had multi-millions of value in my property at where I live, and it's not so many millions now. So, I mean, but as like I say, as the grass is growing, the horse is starving. So, yes, you can get the money. End game is you get it, but it might be a year, 2 years, 3 years. If you wait for the bank to take this over and sell it, you're easy looking at 2 or 3 years.
I wasn't suggesting that they would have to liquidate the property in order to access those assets. I was just indicating that the assets are in the property, and as a result, they're willing to move forward and comply with the orders.
And property, generally speaking, is worth more if it's in compliance with the law than if there are outstanding violations.
No question.
And in addition, I might have done an imperfect job explaining it. I'm not a technical person, but as a result of the height of the wall and the backfill, there was reduced area of habitat as a result, and there's a direct link to the butterfly, therefore.
Got it.
Commissioner McClure.
Yeah, I have a couple of technical questions that I'd like to ask through the chair of staff, and it kind of runs on this same line, because I don't know if we have any assets that we can maybe. My goal is to get it cleaned up and get it back to where it needs to be, and probably sooner than later. So the question becomes is that we know there are going to be fines that are going to come in from this from this property? No. We don't know.
No, there are no fines imposed by the commission administratively. This is simply a cease and desist order and restoration order. If it goes to litigation, then there might be award of fines. But right now, staff does not, the commission does not have the authority to impose fines on alleged violators. It only has the authority to issue cease and desist orders and restoration orders.
We can seek fines through litigation, but we can't do it administratively.
Okay, so this commission would, not possible at this point.
This commission would have to make an affirmative decision that they wanted to pursue litigation in order
and then
for
it
us
goes
to,
through a process.
That's correct.
Okay, and then how about any kind of partnership with the city or county? Like in my community, there's a blight ordinance that this could probably fall under, and then they can come in and clean it up and restore it.
This might be part of a larger discussion about the role of enforcement in the Coastal Act, but just as a general policy matter, the Coastal Act requires the violator to restore the violation. And in this case, as in most of our cases, we believe that that's feasible. It would be unfortunate if we turned to restricted local government with their restricted amounts of funds and made restoration of Coastal Act violations dependent upon finding those sorts of resources.
I agree, but it would be more unfortunate to have a extinct butterfly. You think that's over? That may be a bit exaggerated.
I think in every one of our cases, if it were possible, the person responsible for doing the violation would rather have someone else pay for restoring it. And unfortunately, those kinds of resources simply aren't generally available, and we would like to continue to restore habitat and Coastal Act violations the way that the Coastal Act envisioned by having the parties responsible for them doing it. Generally speaking, that serves not only a practical purpose because the funds are more available that way, but also it falls into the deterrent scheme of the Coastal Act. Otherwise, people that violate the Coastal Act would be rewarded, and people that complied with the Coastal Act would be out the costs associated with compliance. And that's not the way to avoid future violations, we think. And it's sort of helpful. It fits into the overall scheme. That helps?
No. The part that is hard for me to get is that there. Let's say I know that it's not directly to this case, but you know there's a violation, and the goal is to fix it, and I understand that. But there should be some way in the mechanism that gets fixed. If we get into litigation and it goes for 2 years or 3 years, then the fix languishes, and isn't there? There should be some way that we could encumber those fines that we're going to collect, or encumber the, or put a lien on the property that we fix. But somehow the fix needs to happen, because I find it frustrating that if I have a illegal dumper somewhere and it's 3 years later, it's.
It's
frustrating.
I think I'm struggling with the apparent assumption by a number of commissioners that we won't get compliance here. We have every reason to believe that we will, and we've been working very hard to ensure that. We did put a notice of violation on the property to avoid a misunderstanding. We can't it doesn't have the legal standing of a lien, but it has in many cases the effect of a lien. Okay. We can't put a lien on until we have a judgment, and then you can put a formal lien on. This might be a better for a non-site-specific discussion,
right. Yes.
But
I think that's
the costs of violations would swamp the ability of any public agency to remedy them. And in most cases, the faster way is working with the violator. And we've had a lot of success. We have the number of consent orders we bring to the commission is in excess of 50%, even of the difficult cases that don't resolve informally.
Okay.
I might also point out that, unfortunately, we're limited in terms of the resources and the tools that we have available.
Right.
We tried for several years to get legislation that would give the commission the authority to impose administrative penalties. That was opposed by, you can imagine who would oppose that. And that's made it very difficult for the commission and very costly for the state to enforce violations of the Coastal Act. Administrative fines would have made it a lot cheaper, saved the Attorney General a lot of money. But we do what we can with the resources that we have. So we share your frustration.
I appreciate the answers, and I understand that it's a more global discussion for how do we fix things rather than this case.
Right.
And thank you.
So I'd like to interject here and just remind the commission that at least your chair has to catch a plane. So if we could focus on the motion before us, which is a question of cease and desist, it clearly seems to me from this discussion that that staff should think about having a briefing kind of on our enforcement, who they are, what they do, how they prioritize, and what our remedies are. But if I could please ask that we focus on... There is a motion before us now, which is a cease and desist. I have several commissioners who would like to speak for a second time, but before that, I'll ask Commissioner Gurney.
Thank you. Very briefly, what I note is we have a violation that's not backed up with fines. We have one party with stated resources to address that, Mr. Campbell, and he has no ownership interest in this house now, which is what is my understanding from the divorce, so I don't see him as a potential solution in think we need to perhaps concentrate on Mrs. Campbell and get this done. It looks like that's what the commission would like. Perhaps I'm wrong in that analysis. Maybe Mr. Campbell is actually some sort of resource for this correction to us, but if he doesn't have control over their property, I don't know what he's going to be able to do.
The orders impose joint and several liability on both of the Campbells, so either or both of them will be fully responsible, and to the extent that Mrs. Campbell is in more direct control, she may very well be the person who is more likely to do the work, and she will be fully responsible for doing so. If for some reason she doesn't, Mr. Campbell would be responsible for participating in any way he could.
The orders also have a participate and cooperate clause with regard to Mr. Campbell. So if he didn't have access to the property, he could certainly contribute to the costs of the restoration. And the orders apply equally to him, and any potential penalty action would apply equally to him. He is liable under the statute as a person who performed or undertook the unpermitted development, regardless of his current ownership of the property. We have a lot of cases involving prior owners.
Commissioner Zimmer, would you like to address whether or not
the commission should?
Thank
I'll
you.
I'll defer.
Commissioner Resnick, thank you. Any further discussion? Any unwillingness for a vote? Would staff prefer a roll call on this? No. All right. Any unwillingness for unanimous vote? Seeing none, the commission unanimously approves the motion, which results in the issuance of a cease and desist order. Commissioner Resnick, would you?
Yeah. Thank you. I move that the Commission issue restoration order number CCC-11-RO-03 pursuant to the staff recommendation and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Commissioner Resnick, seconded by Commissioner Zimmer. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No.
Commissioner Zimmer, is there any unwillingness to vote? Seeing none, the Commission unanimously unanimously approves the motion, which results in the issuance of the restoration order as set forth in the staff report. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That brings us to the North Coast portion of the agenda. And in deference to the hour, I will try to be brief. I realize that commissioners need to catch planes. there is a deputy director's report, the pink addendum that contains one waiver for the installation of a siren and a tsunami siren in Trinidad. We're aware of no opposition or controversy involving this item, and we recommend that the commission concur with the executive director's determination to grant the waiver.
Thank you. Is there any unwillingness for concurrence? Seeing none, we'll deem it concurred in.
There is no North Coast consent calendar, so that brings us to item 10A, which is a public hearing in action on the LCP amendment submitted by Delnert County to amend General Plan Public Works Policy Number 1 of their land use plan to include a provision that would allow for a sewer and water line to be extended outside of the urban services boundary to serve the Elk Valley Rancheria's Resort Casino Project. Green addendum that was distributed to you this morning and yesterday has a couple letters of support for the project from the Elk Valley Rancheria and also the Carpenters Union. Commission may remember that in April you extended the time to July for action on this project. The amendment would facilitate the Elk Valley Rancheria Resort Casino project by simply providing for that exception language. We believe that the amendment is supportable and that it approves extension of services to a development that's already been approved by the commission. Our one suggested modification has to do with the fact that since this resort casino project was initiated, the Elk Valley Rancheria has also initiated, they've purchased land and put into trust a small motel that's very close to the resort casino project. And the goal is to put that into a visitor-serving housing use in the future. And the the site has a septic system built about circa 1950, and so we felt that to ensure that all of the Elk Valley Rancheria's operations, to ensure that they'd be consistent with your water quality and biological protection policies of the Coastal Act, that an exception also be created to ensure that at the time when that's developed, that the lines could be extended to that site as well. I'll point out that there are limitations in the language of the amendment as proposed that would preclude the lines being used by adjoining properties to prevent an inducement of growth that could otherwise occur. And so we understand that the Rancheria and the county, of course, are in support of the recommendation. And with that, I'll conclude and recommend that the commission, upon completion of the hearing, deny the amendment as submitted and then certify the amendment if modified as suggested per the commission's procedure. And the motions and resolutions are found on pages 5 and 6 of the staff report.
Thank you, staff. We have no speakers. Oh, first, are there any ex parte communications on this? Seeing none, we have no speaker slips. I'll call on Commissioner McClure.
Yes, I would like to move that the commission certify the land use plan amendment number DNC-MAJ-1-10 as submitted by the County of Del Norte and recommend a no vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Commissioner McClure, seconded by Commissioner Stewart. Would you like to speak to your motion?
I just want to make sure that the county and the Rancheria are on the modifications, and so I'm pretty sure they are, and I'm okay.
Commissioner Stewart, is there any further discussion? Any unwillingness via unanimous no vote? Seeing none, it has been unanimously rejected. Commissioner McClure.
I move that the commission certify the land use plan amendment number DNC-MAJ-1-10 for the County of Del Norte if it is modified as suggested in this staff report and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Commissioner McClure, seconded by Commissioner Stewart. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No.
No? Any unwillingness to vote? Seeing none, the commission unanimously approves the motion, which results in the certification of the land use plan amendment with the suggested modifications and the adoption of the resolutions and findings set forth in the staff report.
As I mentioned earlier, there were three postponements, so that brings us to the last item, which is item 13A, which is a public hearing and action on revised findings for the LCP amendment submitted by Humboldt County to redesignate and rezone the old company town of Samoa on the Samoa Peninsula in Humboldt County. The commission certified this LCP amendment with suggested modifications back in March. The commission's action differed in certain significant respects from the written staff recommendation. So in these kinds of situations, your regulations provide that the staff is to prepare revised findings for your consideration. The procedure today does not allow the commission to reconsider the merits of the amendment. You're simply looking at the revised findings and their adequacy to support the action that you took in March. And there are only certain commissioners that are eligible to vote on the findings, those commissioners that were on the prevailing side, and those include Commissioners Blank, Bloom, Burke, Mitchell, Schallenberger, and Stone. And and of course, only Commissioners Bloom, Burke, Mitchell, and Schallenberger are currently here. The amendment, the main difference in the commission's action from what staff had recommended had to do with the appeal jurisdiction. The commission was aware that with a very complicated set of suggested modifications that the commission had imposed in the LCP amendment, that future development decisions would likely raise potential substantial issues that the commission wanted to ensure that they'd always have the ability to review on appeal. Under the Coastal Act, the Commission has appeal jurisdiction in a variety of geographic areas and for a variety of projects. One of those is if the development that's considered is between the first through public road paralleling the sea and the sea. And in this case, the Commission has determined in the past that the first public road in this area goes around the other side of Humboldt Bay, with the result that all of the area from that road across the bay and over the Samoa Peninsula where this site is located is appealable. And so the commission, in acting on the amendment, imposed a mod that would ensure that the roads that might be built under this LCP amendment would not somehow change that. And so in looking at the regulations defining the first public road, there's a provision that one of them is that public road has to be publicly maintained. And so the suggested modification addresses how the roads that would be built under the LCP amendment would not be accepted and maintained by the public. At the meeting, you may recall the county representative indicated that the county would accept such a modification. Since that time, we've heard that their public works department has had some concerns, and we've talked to them about the possibility that in the future they could consider another LCP amendment that would provide a basis for appeal in a different manner. The LCP amendment, we're recommending that the commission adopt the revised findings that provide for that suggested modification language, expelling it out and providing the other changes that were made at the hearing. And as I say, this requires a vote of only the prevailing members of the commission at the time. And the recommendation is, the staff recommendation, the motion is found on pages 4 and 5 of the staff report. And that concludes my remarks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any ex partes on this? Seeing none, I have no speaker slips. Come back to the commission. Commissioner Bloom.
I move that the commission adopt the revised findings in support of the commission's actions on March 10th, 2011, concerning Humboldt County LCP Amendment Number HUMMAJ108, Samoa, and recommend a yes vote.
It has been moved by Commissioner Bloom and seconded by Commissioner Mitchell. And so with that, would you like to speak to your motion? Commissioner Bloom.
I think I
No, other than to say that staff, I think, got it right. There was broad support for this moving forward with the commission's request that this one additional item be added. So here it is.
Commissioner Mitchell? Commissioner Resnick.
One point of order. I was serving as an alternate. I'm pretty sure I voted on it. But it's, I don't care one way or the other. You already have. I was worried about a quorum for having enough folks, but.
Well, in checking the record, I didn't have your name on there. So if we excluded you, I apologize.
Okay. All those in, this is a show of hands, is that right? All those in favor who are eligible to vote, all those in favor of a yes vote? We have a unanimous of those that are recorded having been on the prevailing side. So the motion results in the adoption of the revised findings set forth in the staff report. Thank you. And we have one public hearing. Commissioner Mitchell.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up my constant mantra of meeting links, et cetera, locations, and say how much I appreciate having this in Los Angeles and how much public input we got, which was the point of my comments at the previous hearing, is having commission meetings in locations where we can get a lot of public input, and I think we did at this meeting. And I think that's wonderful, and that was the point of my comments earlier. But I also wanted to say that I'm looking at the schedule for the next few meetings, and there are 3 meetings in Northern California. So for the next 3 months, we're going to be in Northern California. I realize South Coast, but it's not Southern California. And I'm concerned about, and I know with the leadership of our new chair, balancing sort of people's access to be able to have their issues heard and the public being able to comment on their issues in a timely manner, and balancing the workload, additionally balancing the workload of the commission, because, as you know, I've complained in the past, when we are in Northern California frequently, we barely have 2 days worth of work, and we're staying 3 days because of the way the agendas are set up. And yet, when we're here, people are working 14-hour days, which is fine, but there should just be some sort of balance, and that should be taken into consideration when we're scheduling meetings. And I know no one can really determine how many things are going to be on a particular item, but at the same time, I think there is some historical data to support maybe more meetings in Southern California that to balance where the applications really are. So I know we've passed a schedule for 2012, but I would like that to be at some point revisited for how many, because we're splitting north and south equally, and that's not the basis of the workload. So I would just like, again, with the leadership of our new chair, to have that something that we look into.
Absolutely. And I also think it's not just how many in the north and south, but as much as we can, so that the southern ones are heard in the south and the northern in the north, which is, I think, staff's goal. But I definitely think it's worth revisiting and having a, and in terms of our future, we adopted the schedule, we can change the schedule. So, but I do think it needs to be looked at in terms of where the, what the workload is, not just the volume, but where the permits are coming from as well. All right,
Thank you.
I'm going to go to the public comment, and I have one, David Barish. You'll have 3 minutes.
Good. I think we're still good morning, Honorable Commissioners. Just thank you for having us here. My name is David Barish, co-director of We Are Marina Del Rey. And Santos Kreiman came up earlier and spoke from the beaches of the harbor and said that things have changed since he came on board. And that is true. There are things have changed. Some projects that were slated are now off the table, which is fantastic. But those projects were really egregious projects that couldn't even get by Peter Douglas and Jack Ainsworth. So, when you're going to build a hotel on Mother's Beach, the most popular beach in the marina, and you want to build apartments on the public boat long tramp of the biggest man-made marina in the country, there's something wrong with that. So we got left. So we're told, well, you can't get everything you want. And I realize that. But what happens when what's left on the table is egregious, too? Let's talk about, one of the projects that's slated to go on a public parking lot is they're changing the land use category to seniors accommodation. Now, that's we're alleging that that's discrimination. Creating a whole land use category for a specific age group of people I've never heard of before. This is probably the first time. We don't feel that's right, even regarding the fact that this is public land for public recreation. This is not consistent with the Coastal Act. And then you have other projects. We're not opposed to some redevelopment of apartments that are, they're run down, they were built in the 60s. Yeah, go ahead and build them, but follow the LCP. Have the proper view corridors, have the proper heights. They're not doing that. Everything's supersized and kind of just getting around. You change the wording in the EIRs, and you kind of queer, as Daniel Gottlieb would say, the meaning of the LCP, and they put it in. So those are issues that will come before you. We will, appeal them if necessary. But what we're really saying is we're not against development. We like to see balanced development that's reasonable. Where you already have private development, go ahead, redevelop, but make it just a little bit reasonable. This is not a major urban area, as I pointed out the other day. There's a lot of recreation here. And where you already have recreation, let's keep it. Let's enhance it. Let's make this harbor, my personal vision of what it could be, this unbelievable tourist and recreation center. Ecotourism tied to the Biona wetlands just here. Make a beautiful destination for not only LA County residents, but state tourists and international tourists who come to California. We're right next door to Venice Beach. We can tap into that. Santa Monica. They should be working together to make a marketing plan and a strategy to bring people here. We have bikers coming down from Venice Beach along Via Marina all the time, which is part of the coastal trail. But what do they do there? They say, where's Venice Beach? Where do we go? And people ask me all the time, why don't we have a facility for bikers and joggers who are here? There's so much that can be done that would be in line with the Coastal Act, bring the county money, and still maintain a good residential community. So anyway, thank you for your time. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners, I'm sorry I forgot that there was a stack left over for this morning, so we do have more public comments. And next will be Jan Book and then Dan Gottlieb.
Good morning. My name is Jan Book. I live in Marina Del Rey, and I am an attorney. Yesterday, I spoke with you, the commissioners, and good afternoon, by the way. I'll make this quick, about the CEQA, which was a California Environmental Quality Act, which you can find in Public Resources Code, Division 13. Today, I'd like to speak to you about the California Coastal Act, which also can be found in Public Resources Code, however, Division 20. And I'm only going to talk to you about six code sections that I think are really quite relevant to you today. First of all, be Section 30335.1, which you'll find in Chapter 4, dealing with the powers of the Commission. That's you guys, okay? And Article 3, which deals with your powers and duties. I'm going to quote from the code section. The Commission shall provide for appropriate employees on the staff of the Commission to assist applicants and other interested parties in connection with matters which are before the Commission for action. The assistance rendered by these employees shall be limited to matters of procedure and shall not extend to advice on substantive issues arising out of the provisions of this division, such as advice on the manner in which a proposed development might be made consistent with the policy specified in Chapter 3. Chapter 3, that's the section, code section, which deals with planning and management policies and the standards by which the adequacy of local coastal programs are determined. I'd also like to point out that Section 30224, increased recreational boating use of coastal waters shall be encouraged in accordance with this division by developing dry storage areas, increasing public launching facilities, providing additional berthing spaces within existing harbors, and limiting non-water-dependent land uses that congest access corridors and preclude boating support facilities. Also, I'd like to point out that the legislative further, this has to do with Section 3001.5, legislature further finds and declares that the basic goals of the state for the coastal zone are to be maximize public recreational opportunities in the coastal zone. Also, under Section 3003, all public agencies and all federal agencies shall comply with the provisions of this division. And finally, under Section 3003.6, the legislature further finds and declares that the public has a right to be fully participate in the decision-making, and I want to thank you. It goes on, my time's up, and I want to thank you very much for your attentiveness. I'm very impressed. This is my first time speaking before you, but I'm very impressed by your attention, your questions that you ask, and I look forward to seeing you in October.
Thank you very much. Dan Gottlieb, and then John Nahas. If anybody has anything to give the staff, would they give it to them in advance? And if those would the next in line would come forward and be in the front row, we could move along here. Please, your name for the record.
My name is Daniel, Professor Daniel Henry Gottlieb. I live in Marina Del Rey. I'd like to discuss the three pillars of the amendment that is based on three things: a traffic study, a slip study, and a parking study. Today, I want to address the parking study, and what I'm passing out to you is two things. The clip, the two-page document, is part of something I had earlier sent to the commission, but it's relevant now, and the second one is a little proof of what I'm saying. So, at a CCC meeting in the morning in Santa Monica, public comment, John Nahas showed a video illustrating the manipulation of pricing to spin the misrepresentation of the SLIPS vacancy rates in various Marina Del Reys. This is a form of blight engineering. NASA's video followed a video of fulldisclosure.net, which showed the Department of Beaches and Harbors in the act of making their parking lots unpopular with the public. So the new commissioner should make an effort to see this very entertaining and disturbing video. The parking study does not study all of the parking lots in the marina. In fact, Parcel A is the most important tourist lot left off intentionally. Comparing the Raju parking study on page, if you compare it, you find that there's a discrepancy in the number of lots. The missing parcel A indicates that the Raju studied only a subset of the Marina Del Rey parking lots, but Raju testified under oath that he did all the parking lots studied in his report. Since his report never mentions any other parking lots, he probably received inaccurate information from the Department of Beaches and Harbors. The remaining table, okay. And that brings me to this other page. If you look where it says old in my handwriting, this is a document from the LCP, the amendment of the LCP, and you'll see that parking lot A is crossed out. Now, I just had a discussion with somebody representing the county, which said that parking lot A didn't exist anywhere. You know, wasn't part of the county, wasn't part of Marina Del Rey.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
The cross out means that it was in the LCP.
John Nahas.
And they're removing it.
And then Kathy Wright. Kathy Knight, sorry.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Nahas. That picture was for this morning because you guys spent a lot of time here last night trying to soften the mood. You have approximately 1 hour left for Commissioner Boot Camp for your new commissioners, and kind of wanted to soften it this morning, but since you guys have already gone through, I'm gonna kind of quickly go through this. This is stories with holes, things I do with my students. This is a creative thinking exercise. The man was afraid to go home because the man with the mask was there. I had the students ask me yes or no questions, and so I'm gonna have you think about that as I give my presentation. What did we learn from the hearing yesterday? Yesterday was not only awkward for you as commissioners, it was awkward for us as the public, because when you're talking about revoking a CDP, when you're talking about deception of this commission, we feel awkward as well. And because there were so many new commissioners, there was a large overturn of the commissioners, you felt that you really didn't have, when it came to test number three, you couldn't really say what those commissioners back in 2007 would have said. So it really became awkward for us as well, listening to you say that. Integrity of this commission is paramount. We are supporters of you in every sense of the word, and we need to have the integrity of this commission upheld at every stance. And who really loses if you somehow are involved in deception? Well, we know the answer. It's the public. We are the ones that lose. 99%. It's not the developers. It's not the lobbyists that constantly call you. It's us, the public, that loses.
Tax on sophistry.
Can you turn
if
that
we
up,
have
please?
That, we could pay for every program in the state.
So, Mr. Douglas says sophistry. If we had a nickel for every time it happened to this commission, we could pay for everything in this state, and it happens a lot here. So we need to create mechanisms. Communications with the public need to happen within 48 hours. We can contact Santa Barbara or any other of your jurisdictions, and we get emails back or we get phone calls back. For some reason in this commission, it doesn't happen. So we need to impress upon your staff, hey, call these guys back, email them back. It's not that difficult. When we call the Natural State or the State Resources Agency, it's not that hard. We can get communication back. We are the canaries in the coal mine. If something is going wrong, you know that we should be able to communicate with you. Lobbyists, equal time. Chairman Schallenberger had a great thing come out yesterday where she said, you know, what in the staff report didn't you like when she told a lobbyist that? We want to keep on hearing those kind of things. prepare to avoid this to avoid the Streamlining Act. That kills us when it gets to a point where we got to hear this because of the Streamlining Act. And gets lots of rest. We're going to see you in October. Thank you for everything you do.
Thank you. Kathy Knight, and then Shelley.
Wake up.
I'm back.
Sorry. Kathy Knight, are you here?
Not here.
Okay, then we go on to Shelley.
Hi.
Okay, thank you. And then after that will be Patricia McPherson.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Shelley Taniguchi. I serve as the president of the board of directors for Marina Del Rey Outrigger Canoe Club. So I have 2 points today, and I won't take up too much of your time because I am mindful it is lunchtime. My 2 points is, one, to tell you a little bit about our club, and then secondly, to speak about working with LA County Beaches and Harbor. So Marina Del Rey has been here in the marina for 44 years. We were founded by a family member of the Kahanamokus, Duke Kahanamoku, the famous surfer. Our club is the largest outrigger canoe club in Southern California. To give you an example, our club has 200 members. Our youngest paddler is 8, and our oldest paddler is 77. So we really serve a very broad range of people within the community, and they are from all over, Marina Del Rey as well as Los Angeles County. What we also do as a project, as a way to give back to the community, is we work with the Makapu Project, which is located down in Orange County. They are a nonprofit organization that provides outrigger paddling experience to introduce outrigger paddling to blind and visually impaired adults and youth. And that is something that we do on a regular basis as well. So I wanted to give you that background to also give you context that with all the redevelopment that has been happening here within the marina, our group, as well as the alliance that we have formed with other organizations that enjoy beach access and really provide water recreation for adults and youth, such as Kayaks for Kids and the LA Row Club, we have been working in tandem with Director Santos, LA Beaches and Harbor, Richard Bruckner's office, as well as Kanabe's office, and we've been really impressed, and this is my purpose in being here, is to really express gratitude to their group for really being willing to work with us, to hear our needs, and really work with us in terms of providing both access, affordable parking, certainly clean water for us to really continue enjoying the sport that we love to do and continue to recruit and introduce new members of the community to this wonderful sport that we do. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Patricia McPherson and then Ruck Goodreyer. Patricia's not here. Okay, Ruck Goodreyer and then Robert Vanderhoek. Roy.
My name is Robert Vanderhoek, and I am a biologist, and thank you for the opportunity to speak, Commissioner Chair Mary Schallenberger. This is part three, and I'm going to attempt to connect the dots here on the historical ecology and a paradigm shift that's happening in California amongst biologists and researchers, and it's even conservationists, and that is that there were only three locations in the state of California where salt water came into an estuary or a bay 365 days a year. That would have been, that's San Francisco Bay, that's Tamales Bay, and San Diego Bay. All the rest of our wetlands, coastal wetlands in the state of California, whether it's Humboldt Bay, which also closed off to the sea every year with a sandbar across it, Morro Bay, which had a sandbar go across it, Mission Bay, Newport Bay, Magoo Lagoon is permanently kept open, but it had sandbar across it. That's part of the ecology, and the paradigm shift is being led by Dr. Travis Longcore and David Jacobs, who's an expert on the tidewater goby and its evolution and genetics. What that means, if sandbars close off a wetland and there's no salt water coming in for 6 months of the year, is that they begin to turn fresh water in their emphasis. And then that's how you get another kind of ecosystem. Now, marine biologists, some of them don't like that because then they don't have salt water in year-round, and people who have built harbors and that fall into suit along that too. But if a harbor's already been built, like this yacht harbor, it actually now plays a role to supplement an existing wetland next to it called the Biona Wetlands. So we don't try to advocate for removing a yacht harbor. Now you try to have the yacht harbor work to support the wetlands. Halibut are all over the bottom of this harbor. You also want to have sea otters in here and bald eagles and osprey on platforms. In fact, the osprey is here. It's a very large seahawk. And have the fish ecosystem work into the whole ecosystem. Six yacht harbors have sea otters. There's no reason this yacht harbor can't have sea otters in it also. The Elkhorn Slough Yacht Harbor is most famous for the number of that. And I want to spend the last few minutes playing a tape of one bird song here that's endangered. It's called the California Black Rail.
Black Rail.
Okay.
Very appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Vernon Marino. And Ruck is not here, is that right?
Is this the control to make the slide go? Okay.
Good afternoon, honorable commissioners. My name is Nancy Vernon Marino, and I am co-director of We Are Marina Del Rey. And in order to put Marina Del Rey into a better perspective, or one that we like better, I would like to take you on a brief detour back in time to show you, to illustrate for you, what our future could be. In Wikipedia, Central Park is called the crown jewel of this island. It is 843 acres of public recreational land designed by the visionary landscape architects Calvert Vaux and Frederick Law Olmsted in 1857. Next, which is this one? Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay, I'll just tell you in advance. Thank you. It's 843 acres of public recreational land designed in 1857. It was developed by the City of New York for the benefit of its citizens, and more than seven generations have enjoyed its breathtaking beauty and its diverse recreational opportunities. It is the most visited park in the nation. Next slide, please. Throughout its history, many economic cycles have occurred, but over the years, including through two major industrial era depressions as well as a financial collapse in the mid-70s that did not get a federal bailout, this park remained true to its promise. Next slide, please. There are structures on the land, but they are public structures, or they are very minor maintenance support structures. Next slide, please. Here's another one, sailing. I thought that was cute, from model boats. Next slide, please. This is the literary promenade, sculptures and promenades and drives and ball fields and just all kinds of things for people to do, from the very active and energetic marathon finishes to quiet contemplative areas in the park. The park has remained true to the people. Next slide, please. Belvedere Castle, some historic things, of course, since it's New York. Next slide, please. 25,000 trees and numerous denizens. There's an opossum down in the right-hand corner there. Next slide, please.
the resident pale male, which is a red-tailed hawk, and migratory birds such as the black-crowned night heron that you are probably very familiar with here. Next slide, please. True to its promise as a park, that's the value. They resisted the temptation. Please do that with the marina no more.
Thank you.
And that is our last public comment. I believe with that, staff,
our great staff,
we're done.
You're done.
Right?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was really a good job. We worked hard. I appreciate your attention and your support.
Thank you. Travel safely.